I'd like to call the meeting to order. I'd like to have a roll call, please.
Commissioner Tatian?
Here.
Commissioner Lang?
Here.
Commissioner Burke?
Almost here.
Commissioner Lowenthal?
Here.
Commissioner Wetzel?
Here.
Commissioner Crabb?
Here.
Commissioner Neely?
Here.
Commissioner Potter?
Here.
Commissioner Riley?
Here.
Commissioner Schallenberger?
Here.
Commissioner Wan?
Here.
Chair Kruger?
Here. We have a quorum. First of all, before I go back to staff, I'd like to welcome our newest commissioner, Commissioner Lowenthal. And Commissioner, congratulations. You're being sworn in this morning. And would you like to say something to the commission or the audience?
Thank you. I just want to thank everyone for the warm welcome. You've all been so kind to me, and I appreciate this. And the opportunity and honor is tremendous to serve in this capacity on the Coastal Commission. For those of you who don't know, I represent the 2nd District in the City of Long Beach, City Council. And that district incorporates a great majority of the Port of Long Beach as well as the coast. And district residents, even though they may not live that close to the coast, really rely on our beaches for their quality of life and look to the Coastal Commission to protect that and ensure that those resources will always be there. I also have worked in water policy for the last 10 years, 8 of which have been at West and Central Basin Municipal Water District working on water issues, and some issues have come before the Coastal Commission. Currently, I work at the Water Replenishment District as their chief strategist and planner, and we do groundwater resources. And so my interest is very deep in the work that you do, both from a inland waterways aspect as well coastal waterways. So this is quite an honor. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Lowenthal. And we're very honored that you could be here on behalf of all the commissioners, and thank you for participating. With that, I'd like to go to the staff for announcements and procedures for today's hearing.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I think you know from the notice that we sent to you that Vanessa Miller was taken to the hospital on Sunday night. Unfortunately, her situation is quite grave. She has a gallbladder issue and pancreas issue and will remain in the hospital, and I understand have to undergo some surgery. So Jeff Staben and Paul have agreed. We recruited them at the last minute to come down here and help us out. So we're going to ask for your indulgence today to understand us as we try to work through this, and I think we will. One of the initial oversights that we had this morning was not setting up the timer, which we will do when you take a break. We'll get that on, and I think Commissioner Wan has the old-fashioned timer that we had before, and if you can't work it, you can give it to me.
I may or may not know how to work it.
Okay. For folks in the audience, please turn off your cell phones. If you want to address the commission, fill out a speaker slip. They're found on the table outside the room. Also, if you have any materials to hand out to the commission, please get them to the staff so we can distribute those as soon as possible. And I'll ask Charles to go over changes on the agenda in a minute. But I just want to point out to those of you who are relatively new, and I think I mentioned this to Commissioner Hueso this morning, trying to understand the length of the agenda as we look at this meeting down here. We tried to get all of the items that we had on the agenda into the 3 days. The first item that would have been on today, the UC LRDP, UC Santa Cruz, those of you who've been in the past hearings know that that would have taken a good part of the day had it stayed on. The reason that it was postponed was because of a previous delay allowing a third-party review of the wetland determination on the property by the Corps of Engineers and EPA. And they did identify some additional wetlands, which our biologist has, as I understand it, agreed with. And so the university, we were prepared to proceed even in light of that information, but the university decided that they needed more time to respond, and the matter has been postponed. So that takes a half a day at least off the agenda today. And as a result of the formation of the agenda, Friday is a long day. And we hadn't had the postponements that we thought we were going to have for Friday, so please be prepared for a longer Friday than you're used to. We'll try to move it along as quickly as we can, but Friday, my guess is we'll probably go until 1 o'clock at least on Friday. So with that, let me...
Director Douglas, yes. Let me just comment that I'm glad you raise that issue, but and every time you usually raise that issue that maybe this will be a shorter meeting, we can't predict how long the thing goes. It usually goes twice as long, so you jinx it. So I'm glad you laid it out there for us, but I appreciate those comments. Dr. Lester.
I'm sure we'll find a way to fill the time.
Yeah. Hopefully that will be with Jack's agenda. On changes for today on page 4, as Mr. Douglas just indicated, item 8A, the UCSC-LRDP, has been postponed. Item 8B, the San Luis Obispo LCP amendment, major 204, part 1, was withdrawn by the county. On page 4, item 9A, the Dowd appeal has been postponed. On page 5, item 11A, Cornell, has been postponed by a request from the applicant as a matter of right. Also on page 5, item 12A, the Siobhan Smith enforcement item has been postponed. Item 12B, the related item, Siobhan Smith in San Mateo County, has been postponed. On page 6, item 15A, LA County Department of Public Works recommending move to consent, as well as item 15B, LA County Department of Public Works. And on page 7, Sadler 15C is recommended move to consent. Also on page 7, item 15D has been withdrawn, the Delia application. Also on page 7, 15F has been postponed. And 16A has been postponed.
That brings
okay.
us.
Go ahead.
That brings us to the North Central Coast District Deputy Director's report, and I have one minor item to report on today, which is a de minimis waiver for a temporary observation project at the Bodega Marine Laboratory, and I'm not aware of any objections to that waiver.
Any objection to concurrence? Hearing none, we, the commission, concur.
So that would bring us to item 5A, and there is a presentation for this item, a PowerPoint presentation. This item is a major LCP amendment in San Mateo County, number 1-06. San Mateo County is proposing some site-specific changes to provisions of the county's LCP that affects three parcels located on the Miramar Beach restaurant property in Miramar, San Mateo County. This slide shows you the general location. This is the property in question here. This is the Miramar Beach restaurant, and the LCP changes are being proposed for both some existing lots that are covered currently by parking for this restaurant, as well as an approximate 8,000 square foot area generally in this location. Now, specifically, the proposed LCP amendment would affect three parcels and includes an LUP map amendment to change the land use designation from medium low density residential to general commercial, and also an implementation plan zoning amendment to change the zoning designation from single family residential to parking design review. The purpose of the amendment is to facilitate the expansion of the Miramar Beach restaurant parking lot and it, as it relates to a proposed expansion of the outdoor restaurant patio seating of the restaurant on the property adjacent to the three parcels that would be amended through this amendment. Overall, staff is recommending that the LCP amendment be approved only if modified, as recommended by staff. We're not aware of any objections to the proposed modifications from the county or the property owner. This has been a project-driven LCP amendment to facilitate the project that I just mentioned. We are recommending a number of several modifications to address a couple of issues. One of these is simply a technical correction at the request of the county staff. Although they formally changed the zoning to general commercial, their intent was to change it to a visitor-serving commercial land use designation. So we would be recommending a modification to clarify that. That would be consistent with the other general visitor-serving commercial designation and zoning in the area. The second major issue that we're recommending a modification to address is the question of traffic capacity, highway capacity, road capacity, and particularly as it relates to cumulative impacts and impacts to public access along this stretch of the mid-coast to San Mateo County. Some of you may recall that the traffic capacity in this section of San Mateo County is severely limited. There's two major highways, Highway 1 and Highway 92, that provide access to this section of the coast. And the commission has previously raised concerns about the lack of available traffic capacity, particularly as it concerns the ability of visitors to get to this section of the shoreline. So we are recommending that site-specific modifications or policies be included with this amendment that would require specifically traffic demand management mitigation measures to be incorporated into the project to offset the increased demand of this project. Although it is an LCP amendment to facilitate a priority use, visitor-serving use, which is a good thing under the Coastal Act, it will result in increased traffic impacts and particularly cumulative impacts that we think need to be addressed at the project design level. So one modification would require that traffic be analyzed and that mitigation measures be developed to offset the potential traffic increase related to the proposed land use change. Related to that, and in order to offset the cumulative impacts to public access and recreation, we are recommending modifications that would require a more specific evaluation of general public access parking opportunities in the vicinity of this area. Currently, parking for the general public is limited to the residential streets, which are somewhat informally developed, and there isn't a lot of parking along the main frontage here because it's a very narrow street, and then there's this revetment fronting the beach. There are required parking, public access parking spaces in the existing parking lot currently, but those are limited right now from 10 to 4 p.m., so you can't you can't park in these areas before 10 a.m. or after 4 p.m., which we think is a significant limitation on general public access ability to get to this area of the coast. There's also a lateral trail access that begins here and heads up coast from this general vicinity, so we're recommending modifications that would require the examination of signing opportunities and specifically designating additional parking in the new parking structure that would be built or parking lot that would be built in order to accommodate general public access. Finally, we are recommending modifications to deal with the specific water quality concerns associated with new parking development, and those are basically BMPs and a requirement to maximize pervious surfaces to the extent feasible. So I will conclude there. Again, we aren't aware of any objections to these modifications, and we would recommend denial as submitted and approval as modified.
Thank you, Dr. Lester. With that, I'll return to the commission for ex parties. I'll start on my left. Are there any ex parties from any of the commissioners on this subject? No ex parties. Okay, with that, I'll open the public hearing. And I have one speaker slip, Paul McGregor. Sir, how much time are you requesting?
Very little.
How much is very little?
1 minute.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Paul McGregor. I'm here to represent the Miramar Beach Restaurant. I hope you had a chance to review the restaurant expansion project. This project will not only enhance more public parking and access to the beach area at Miramar, it will also employ many locals and keep less traffic off the Highway 92 corridor. Our goal is to continue the visitor-serving establishment that has served the community for many years and to continue preserving the access and views that all the people desire. Our project has full community support, and we hope you feel the same. If you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Thank you, Mr. McGregor.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming today. Dr. Lester, any response?
Just a quick clarification that you are reviewing the land use plan changes and implementation plan changes, not the project itself, although, as I mentioned, this is a project-driven LCP amendment, so it's relevant to what you just heard from the project applicant. And also, the motions for denial and adoption are found on pages 4 and 5.
Thank you very much. I'll come back to the commission. The pleasure of my colleagues. Commissioner, would like to make any motion? Commissioner Potter?
You got it.
Mr. Chair, I move the commission certify land use plan amendment number SMC-MHA-1-06 as submitted by the County of San Mateo. Recommend a no vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Commissioner McNeely. Commissioner Neely, and they're recommending a no vote. And failure of this motion will result in the denial of the amendment as submitted and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Is there, you would like to speak to your question, motion, Commissioner Potter?
No.
Okay. Mr. Neely? Is there any objection to a unanimous no roll call vote on this item? Hearing none. Unanimous, no roll call vote.
Mr. Chair, I move that the commission certify land use plan amendment number SMC-MHA-1-06 for the County of San Mateo, if it is modified, as suggested in the staff report. Recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Commissioner Neely. They're recommending a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the certification of the land use plan amendment with suggested modification and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in the staff report. Is there, would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Potter?
No, again.
Thank you. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The commission hereby certifies land use plan amendment number SMC-MHA-106 for the County of San Mateo as modified as suggested in adoption of the findings set forth in the staff report. Commissioner Potter?
Mr. Chair, I move the commission reject IP amendment number SMC-MHA-1-06 for the County of San Mateo as submitted. Recommend a no vote.
Moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Vice Chair Neely. They're asking for a no vote. Failure of this motion will result in the certification of the implementation program amendment as submitted and the adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Is there any objection to a unanimous no roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission hereby certifies implementation program amendment SMC-MHA-106 for the County of San Mateo as submitted and adopts the findings set forth in this staff report. Okay. Thank you. Dr. Lester?
Yes, that brings us to item 5.5A, a new appeal, and there's also a PowerPoint presentation for this brief. This is a new appeal in the city of Half Moon Bay. The city approved the construction of a 2,500-square-foot single-family residence on a 5,000-square-foot lot. The residence would be two stories. The main issue raised by the appellants is the inconsistency with the sensitive habitat protections of the certified LCP. In particular, the lot is located adjacent to Pullman Ditch, which is a riparian area that has been identified as potential in red-legged frog and San Francisco garter snake habitat by both the Department of Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is the general location map showing you the project location in the city of Half Moon Bay. And this is a photo of the site that would be developed with a single-family home, and this is a one view of that riparian area that I just mentioned. Staff, the commission staff, as well as the other resource agencies have previously weighed in with the city planning department on the potential for habitat impacts here. The city has not approved the project consistent with the minimum required setback from this corridor, which is 50 feet. We would recommend that a substantial issue is raised by that inconsistency. There's also some questions raised about whether adequate mitigation measures have been incorporated into the project pursuant to recommendations by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So unless three or more commissioners would like to discuss substantial issue, we would recommend that you find substantial issue and continue the de novo hearing so that we can pursue further action on the permit.
Do three or more commissioners at this time object to finding substantial issue? Hearing none, the commission finds substantial issue. Commissioner Wan?
Just a comment on when they do come back, I think it's important that when they do the studies, to note that when they do the studies for the San Francisco garter snake and the red-legged frog, that they do them using the fish and wildlife protocols. I think that has to be made clear to the applicant, because what we don't want is to have it come back and somebody raise the issue that you didn't find these animals, but you didn't use the right protocols. So if they're going to do it the right way.
We've been coordinating closely with Fish and Wildlife, and we'll assure that that happens.
Also, Mr. Snow, you put in a speaker slip, but because staff recommends substantial issue and the commission has found substantial issue, you could come back, if you would, please, to the de novo hearing, and we're happy to hear your testimony at the de novo part. Thank you. Okay. Central Coast.
Yes, that brings us to the Central Coast Deputy Director's report. And I do have one minor item to report there as well, an immaterial extension for the Chambers project in Santa Cruz County, and I'm not aware of any objections to that.
Any objection to concurrence? Hearing none, the commission concurs.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Charles, is that the balance of your Central Coast report? I had a call from the City of Sand City this morning inquiring about the extension of their desal permit. Could you just let me know what's going on so I can call them back?
We have not completed our research into that extension request, so we aren't reporting it to the commission this month, but it would likely be on in the next month. You know, practically speaking, the application for extension has been made, so the permit is
okay, so
extended until...
I think they're concerned that it may accidentally expire or something. So.
No, as long as the application is pending, it won't expire.
Great. Thanks. I'll let them know.
Is that okay with you, Commissioner Potter, then?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
So that brings us to item 8C.
8C is correct.
And this is a major LCP amendment in Santa Cruz County. It's to address large family child care homes in non-residential zones. We are recommending approval with modifications to address some agricultural issues. And again, the county has not objected to the staff recommendation to adopt with modifications in this case. Briefly, the context for the amendment, large family child care homes may provide care for up to 14 children in a residential setting. The county currently allows large family child care homes in all residential zones. The proposed amendment would allow the operation of these such homes in conjunction with a residential use in certain non-residential zoning districts, including agricultural, commercial, parks and recreation, public and community facilities, and timber zoning districts. With the exception of agricultural zoning districts, staff is of the opinion that the addition of this land use is as an allowable use in existing residences in these other zones would not have an adverse impact on coastal resources. However, allowing the use of large family child care homes on land zoned for agriculture could create conflicts with ongoing farming operations. As you know, standard agricultural practices such as chemical spraying and fertilizing or ongoing agricultural byproducts such as dust and noise could jeopardize continued agricultural activities from complaints that may arise from parents of children in these facilities. These potential impacts and concerns could negatively impact priority agricultural land uses, inconsistent with the ag protection policies of the certified land use plan. Therefore, to ensure consistency with the land use plan, staff is recommending modifications that will remove this land use as an allowable use on agricultural land. Appropriate buffers are also necessary between ag land and non-agricultural land uses to ensure that continued agricultural cultivation is not threatened by proximity to non-agricultural uses such as childcare facilities. However, the proposed amendment would only require an agricultural setback between large family childcare use on non-ag land and adjacent ag land when a structural addition is involved or an intensification of outdoor use will result. This is inconsistent with the certified LCP, which requires specific buffers between commercial, agricultural, and non-agricultural land uses to prevent or minimize potential land use conflicts. Therefore, we are recommending an additional modification to ensure that large family childcare homes located adjacent to agriculturally zoned land meet all the setback requirements of the LCP. That concludes my presentation on this item, and the motions and resolutions are found on pages 2 to 3.
Thank you, Dr. Lester. Any ex parties from the commission on this, starting on my left? No ex parties. We have no speaker slips. Then I'll go to my colleagues, commissioners.
Mr. Chair, I move the commission reject major amendment number 1-06, part 2, to the Santa Cruz County Local Coastal Program Implementation Plan as submitted by Santa Cruz County. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Been moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Commissioner Akajian, and they're recommending a yes vote on this item. And this, the commission then will, with this item, go ahead. Commissioner Potter, would you like to speak to that motion?
No, thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Akajian?
No, sir.
Okay. Any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's been unanimously approved. In other words, the commission hereby denies certification of the major amendment number 106, part 2, to the Santa Cruz County Local Coastal Program Implementation Plan as submitted by the Santa Cruz County and adopts the findings set forth in the staff report. Commissioner Potter?
Mr. Chair, I move that the commission certify major amendment number 1-06, part 2, to the Santa Cruz County Local Coastal Program Implementation Plan. If it is modified as suggested in the staff report, recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Commissioner Akajian. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The commission hereby certifies Major Amendment 1-06, Part 2, to the Santa Cruz County Local Coastal Program Implementation Plan as modified as suggested and adopts the findings set forth in this staff report. Dr. Lester?
Thank you. That brings us to item 10A. There is a PowerPoint presentation for this item. Item 10A is the de novo hearing for an appeal of a subdivision in the rural Los Osos area of San Luis Obispo County. The item was on the agenda last month, at which time the commission found substantial issue and then continued the de novo hearing to allow staff additional time to prepare a revised recommendation. Staff had previously been recommending denial of the subdivision, but based on additional review of the project history and circumstances, we are now recommending that it be approved with special conditions. The appeal has been pending for some time, so we wanted to bring it back as quickly as possible for your consideration. I would note, though, in response to commissioner questions from last month, that while I did indicate last month that the delay in this case was due in large part to our extreme workload and limited staffing, that a substantial part of the delay of nearly a year in this case was also a function of the applicant's request to have additional time to respond to the appeal. So all of that time is added up. I also want to point out there's a brief addendum that has been distributed this morning that adds some additional information and findings to the report, but that does not propose any changes in the current recommendation at this time. I do have one change to Special Condition 2 that I will explain later in the presentation. As I mentioned, the project is a subdivision that would create a single 2-acre parcel in a rural residential area outside of Los Osos. This slide shows you the general vicinity of Morro Bay and Los Osos to the west and the project location to the east of Los Osos Creek, Morro Bay being over here. Before going further into the project, a brief overview of the subdivision and permitting rules in this case is important. In particular, I want to emphasize that there are two state statutes in play here, the Coastal Act and the Subdivision Map Act, and it is important that the distinction between the two authorities is clearly understood. First, the MAP Act provides a process for legalizing or certifying lots that may or may not have been created legally in the first place. There are two kinds of certification, unconditional certificates of compliance, or COCs, and conditional certificates of compliance, or CCOCs, as is the case in this project. Unconditional COCs are typically granted to applicants when they are seeking certification that their lot is legal and that there are no significant questions about how it may have been created. This usually means that the lot or lots in question were created lawfully under the relevant subdivision laws of the county in effect at the time of lot creation. However, in cases where lots may have been created contrary to the relevant subdivision law, a conditional certificate of compliance may be required. For example, if a lot was created by a property owner and a map recorded, but the lot was never reviewed and approved by the relevant subdivision authority as it should have been under the law, then it will be determined that the lot was not legally created. In this case, a COC may be issued to effectively legalize the lot if conditions are met to bring the lot into compliance with the laws that are applicable at the time of certification, if owned by the same party that created the illegal lot, or that would have been applicable at the time that the property owner acquired, a subsequent purchaser acquired the lot. For purposes of the Coastal Act, however, and land use law, unconditional COCs are typically considered ministerial acts and not considered development subject to coastal development permit review because they are simply recognizing the existence of a legal piece of property. Conditional COCs, though, as we have in this case, are development under the Coastal Act because they are considered subdivisions that create new lots at the time the COC is issued. Hence, as with all subdivisions, they must comply with the relevant Coastal Act or LCP policies and ordinances in effect at the time of the issuance of certification, regardless of the circumstances that may apply under the MAP Act. I want to emphasize that here because the applicant's representative has presented arguments suggesting that the Commission is somehow prohibited from applying its authorities under the LCP, as it would for any subdivision in San Luis Obispo County, given the MAP Act rules. However, in short, here, while the MAP Act is applied in this case by the county, points to requiring the applicant to meet requirements in effect in 1971, which is when the applicant bought the property, the Commission must apply the LCP as it exists today to this proposed subdivision. The staff recommendation provides more detail on this requirement on pages 7 to 10, including specific explanation of the clear LCP coastal development permit requirements for processing conditional certificates of compliance as subdivision development. So back to the project at hand. This 2-acre lot in question was given a conditional certificate of compliance by the county because the county has determined that the lot was not legally created pursuant to the relevant rules of the time. This is a slide shows you the general location of the lot here, this long rectangle on the outskirts of Los Osos. The urban area boundary is roughly in here, and this is a rural residential area on the in the transition area between rural residential and agricultural zoning. In this case, according to the county, the illegality of the parcel ties back to a transaction in 1964 when a small well lot was created and sold that did not get the relevant county approvals. As a consequence, the well lot and other remainder lots associated with the transaction were determined to be illegal and subject to future certificate of compliance processes. As a consequence, in this particular case, the county recorded notices of violation on the applicants and other parcels in 1979, which effectively prevented the applicants from selling or otherwise developing the property. The applicants are now seeking certification of their lot so that they can sell the property, according to the applicant. According to the county, in the county's review under the MAP Act, the project has been conditioned to meet the rules that were in effect in 1971, which is when the applicants purchased the lot. The county conditions include requirements to address such health and safety issues related to water supply and waste disposal, such as location of septic and well in proximity to each other, as well as agricultural buffers for the adjacent agricultural areas. In terms of LCP compliance, though, the Commission must review, again, the applicant's request to create a 2-acre lot for compliance with the LCP as it exists currently. The most significant hurdle for the applicant here is lot size. The current minimum parcel size for this area is 5 acres, which the applicant does not meet. The parcel is 2 acres. As you can see in this slide, the project is transitional between rural residential and agricultural areas. The LCP Although this area currently where the parcel is located is zoned rural residential, this block of lots right here, rural residential, it is adjacent to this agricultural zoning, and the zoning that is established by the LCP, the 5-acre minimum for these lots, is a transition zoning in order to minimize conflicts between these two land uses. Exhibit F of the staff recommendation does show the agricultural zoning beginning just to the north of the applicant's property here. All of this area is agricultural zoning to the north and surrounding to the east. I do want to note that there is an error on Exhibit F that mistakenly identifies parcel 003, not the applicant's parcel, which is 002, and that will be corrected in the final report. In any case, on its face, the project is not consistent with the minimum lot size of the LCP. The project also raises concern for protection of agricultural and groundwater supplies. In particular, the LCP has clear policies that mirror the Coastal Act's requirements to protect agriculture, including a prohibition on the creation of new building sites on prime soils. In this case, the minimum lot size requirement is partly designed to assure a smooth transition between residential and agricultural land uses so that each use is not adversely affected by the other. The LCP also requires that conflicts between these uses be avoided or minimized and that agricultural areas be protected. The evidence in this case that we've been supplied with from the county record shows that the parcel that would be created is comprised of prime soils, and according to the county agricultural commissioner, has been farmed in the past in conjunction with adjacent property. So we're sort of in a transition zone with this land between a rural residential use and agricultural use that has occurred and could potentially continue occurring. Nonetheless, it must also be recognized that the land in question is zoned for rural residential development, not agriculture. Thus, bracketing for a moment the question of parcel size, the staff recommendation is proposing to allow the creation of this lot subject to conditions to protect both adjacent agricultural operations and the agricultural potential of the parcel itself in light of the clear LCP requirement to not create building sites on prime soils. These conditions include allowing a minimal non-agricultural building area of approximately 10,000 square feet for a single residential use in order to maximize future options to farm the prime soils on the site and to buffer future residential development from adjacent agriculture to the north. It also requires recordation of a right-to-farm commitment on the applicant to protect adjacent agriculture and also assuring that future non-agricultural water use does not adversely impact ongoing agricultural operations. I would like to make one small change to Special Condition 2 at this time. We received some recent information from the applicant regarding another existing access easement along the southern boundary of their property, so we believe that affects the building envelope slightly and would just adjust in Special Condition 2, change the 585 feet to 545 feet, a difference of 40 feet, and insert the language other restrictive access easements and replace right-of-way with such restricted areas. This will basically accommodate this new information about the existing easement on the property, but not substantively change the recommendation in our view. The conditions proposed also prohibit any future urban services connections to maintain stable urban-rural boundaries. The other major LCP issue raised by the project is protection of the groundwater basin in Los Osos. The commission has been concerned about the overdraft conditions here for a number of years now, and similar to other areas of the coastal zone, has not been allowing the creation of new lots of record until the lack of a sustainable water supply is addressed. In this case, though, since only one lot would be created or effectively certified, and given the other special circumstances of this case, staff is recommending a condition to assure that any future residential water withdrawals from the groundwater basin are offset to assure no net increase in withdrawals. Finally, let me return to the overarching issue of lot size and whether the commission may consider an approval in this case, contrary to the 5-acre minimum. This slide shows in more detail the applicant's proposed lot, which is in red, outlined in red here, and as well as the adjacent lots that were involved in the original transaction leading to the land division violations identified by the county. These are outlined in the white dashed line, basically 10 lots, including this little tiny lot up here is the original well lot that was created that triggered the violation in the county's view. Although the commission has the discretion to deny this subdivision, and that, in fact, was the original staff recommendation here, we do believe the specific circumstances of this case warrant the commission's consideration of an approval of the lot as long as other coastal resource issues can be addressed through special conditions. The reasons for this are many, some of which are elaborated on in the addendum that I passed out. In contrast to other cases, this case only involves the creation of a single lot with no surrounding property owned by the applicant, so it's not a lot split or the creation of multiple parcels. Therefore, the options for the applicant in terms of remedies if the commission were to deny the project are severely limited. This becomes even more clear when we examine the unique circumstances here in the nearly 40 or more plus year history of development and development authorizations on the surrounding parcels that were associated with this illegal transaction. So as described in the addendum and as shown on this slide, for example, in terms of pursuing remedies with adjacent landowners, many of the parcels are developed with single-family residences or have otherwise been legalized by government determinations. This would make it extremely difficult for the applicant to pursue remedies with these other properties. In addition, according to county records, some parcels have also been transferred from the parties to the original legal transfers, making the prospect of multi-party resolution even more difficult. In terms of development patterns, we would note that four of the eight parcels determined to be part of an illegal transaction by the county have residential developments now, although the permitting history of these residences is not entirely clear. In one case, there's no record of a certificate of compliance for what appears to be a non-conforming lot of just under 5 acres, but there's an existing single-family home built in the 1960s, according to the county records. In short, given these specific circumstances, including the development and permitting pattern on other similarly situated parcels that would make alternative resolution of this parcel's illegality extremely difficult, if not infeasible, including the long transaction history, the fact that only a single parcel ownership would be recognized by an approval in this case, and in light of the applicant's assertions that they were a bona fide purchaser unaware of any violations at the time of purchase, staff is recommending that the commission find that the issuance of a coastal development permit in this case would be appropriate if the requirements of the LCP can otherwise be met. In closing, I would note that the commission has taken the question of certificate of compliance issuance very seriously and, in fact, made significant recommendations to the County of San Luis in its adopted periodic review of the San Luis Obispo County LCP several years ago, in order to improve our intergovernmental coordination with respect to this kind of process. The commission has also denied a conditional certificate of compliance that was, or a certificate that was issued under different circumstances in Los Osos. In this case, though, we do believe that the specific and unique circumstances of the applicant's project supports the recommendation of approval and that our proposed special conditions strike an appropriate balance for a case that is admittedly atypical. That concludes the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Dr. Lester, for that explanation. I think that would be very helpful to the commission. With that, I'll move back to the commission and see if we have any ex parte starting on my left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a discussion with Supervisor Gibson, who represents this District 2 in the county of San Luis Obispo, and we pretty much discussed the history of this property as it was reported to us by Dr. Lester this morning, and we were both in agreement of their findings and their recommendation as it is today.
Thank you, Commissioner Kajian. Any others? None? Okay, with that, I'll open the public hearing. Ms. Sullivan? How much time are you requesting, ma'am?
Probably about 2 minutes or less.
That's fine, 2 minutes.
My name is Shauna Sullivan. I'm an attorney with Sullivan Associates. I represent Graciano and Teodora Pataghi, the owners of this property. They wanted to be here today, but Ms. Pataghi had prearranged medical testing this morning, so she couldn't be here. We did make it to the hearing in Santa Barbara, but we missed our hearing, unfortunately. But we were pleasantly surprised to see that the commission and staff was receptive to approving this certificate of compliance and having one issued, and we thank you for that and the staff as well for reversing the prior position to deny this permit. However, we are concerned with the proposed conditions. In addition to the county conditions, the conditions that are before this board, at least until a few moments ago, left a total of 5.3% of the property available for a building. At the time, the rest of it was going to be going to a buffer zone as well as a 60-foot easement that exists. Sorry. So we're concerned that we should be limited to the standards that were in effect in 1971 when my clients bought the property, since they were bona fide purchasers. And at that time, there were no ag buffer zones. There was none of the archaeological. There wasn't the Coastal Commission. None of the requirements that have been imposed. My clients are willing to comply with those requirements and have, in fact, done that. But with regard to the buffer zone, it's such a taking of their property. The county conditioned this upon a 375-foot buffer zone, and that's what we would like to see this board stay with. The most that could be buffered under the laws in effect and the ag policies in effect at the time of the certification was 470 feet because it's a 30-foot easement on the neighboring property. So this is taking far beyond what would be allowed today, what would have been allowed in 1971, because as no buffer zone would have been required, and is also taking more than would have been required at the time the county approved the certification. So what we would like to see is approval of this recommendation with the buffer zone being restricted to the original 375 feet that we concurred with the county to agree to, although, as I said, my clients had no obligation because there were no buffer zones back in 1971. But we agreed to that on the basis that we would move this along and my clients would be able to retire and sell this property, and we're still in that place. We'd like your approval, but we would like to see that number changed to the 375. And thank you for considering this.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Thank you for your testimony. With that, I'll go back to Dr. Lester.
Just briefly, again, I would reiterate that the commission must review this certificate for consistency with the LCP, the rules that are in place today, because it has not been acknowledged as a legal lot. So that's the subdivision development requirements. This is a slide of the originally proposed buffer area, or actually the what we described as the non-residential development envelope area, the rest being restricted to agricultural uses or open space uses. That would be modified by 40 feet, so that would expand up to approximately here, pursuant to the change I made in my presentation. Going back, again, here you can see that with the development pattern, that development envelope would roughly correspond to somewhere in here. This area being available for residential development. We think that's a reasonable condition to meet and provide, given the ability to develop in that similar sort of, here's a residential development on another parcel in a similarly sized area. Other parcels, of course, have expanded to the full use of a parcel with various kinds of uses. But again, here's another residential node. Here's a residential node. So we feel it's a reasonable envelope. It's also consistent with prior commission actions with respect to protection of agricultural areas and sensitive habitat areas, for example, approximately 10,000 square feet for development. We also recognize that we are in this middle ground between buffering existing agriculture to the north and providing agricultural potential on the property itself. So we feel it's a reasonable middle ground position on that question.
Thank you, Dr. Lester. I'll come back to the commission, Commissioner Riley, then Commissioner Akajian.
Yeah, just a couple questions. We got this May 3rd missive from the applicant around several issues, and one was a disagreement about prime soils. I don't know if staff's had a chance to look at that, but...
We have not gone into great detailed analysis of the Ag Commissioner's report. We've been relying essentially on the evidence provided by the Agricultural Commission that these were prime soils for irrigated row crops.
They're citing an NRCS soil survey? that was conducted there? Has staff had a chance to look at that?
We've reviewed that generally, but have relied primarily, again, on the Ag Commissioner's determination that that particular soil type, as identified by the survey, does meet the definition of prime soils if irrigated. So it's consistent with how we've treated soils in other areas.
Okay,
of the coastal
zone. And they're saying, and RCS says, if it's non-irrigated, then it's class 3, so it's a matter of whether it's irrigated or not.
Right, right. That often is the case on these transitional soils.
Also, with the staff's time at approximately a 10,000-square-foot building area, they're claiming in here it's about half that size or less than half that size in terms of what's left. Can staff comment on that?
Well, my calculation of the recommended development envelope was about something over 11,000 square feet as originally recommended. But if you subtract the area that would be normally required for a front yard setback, which I believe is what the applicant was doing, and then you add this additional easement area that she identified that we've responded to, you could make it, you get to a smaller number, but I believe with the revised recommendation, it will be probably in excess of 10,000 square feet available for residential development.
Would that easement area serve as the setback area, or do you know?
There would be, basically, the property line down here, and I think you can see there's an existing informal road on the property here.
Okay.
The county has required, this is about 90 feet currently. That would be expanded to 130 feet under the revised special condition. So it would be 130 feet distance here. The county required a 30-foot access dedication for road development. The applicant has identified an additional 30 feet that are actually required or recorded in all of these properties. So there would be 60 feet for access. Technically, I think the county would require at the time of residential development that a house be set back from the access. So that would be another 10 feet as we read the LCP. So you're talking about 70 feet more. So we believe once you do the math, you still get to about 10,000 or more square feet of development potential.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Rowley, for those questions. Commissioner Kaji?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the Commission approve the Coastal Development Permit number A3SLO05072 pursuant to the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Kajian, seconded by Commissioner Potter. And they're asking for a yes vote, and passage of this will result in the approval of the Coastal Development Permit as conditioned and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in the staff report. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The Commission hereby approves the Coastal Development Permit. Okay. We go to enforcement or none? 13A, is it? To Mr. Ainsworth. We'll go to South Coast District, South Central. Mr. Ainsworth.
Yes, thank you. Sorry for the delay. This is item 13. It's the Deputy Director's report for the South Central District, which is a list of the waivers and immaterial amendments, immaterial extensions for the district. Staff is not aware of any opposition to the items on the District Director's report, and recommends the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determination on these matters.
Is there any objection to concurrence on these matters? Hearing none, the Commission concurs.
The next item is item 13A, and this represents the completion of the amendment process for the Santa Barbara City College Public Works Plan Amendment 1-06. The College has formally agreed to accept the Commission's action on the Public Works Plan Amendment, and therefore staff recommends the Commission concur with the executive director's determination that the actions are legally adequate and this amendment can be effectively certified.
Is there any objection to finding concurrence with the executive director's determination in this matter? Hearing none, the Commission concurs.
The next item is item number 14, and these are the permit items staff is recommending be moved to the consent calendar. Staff is recommending three items be moved to the consent calendar, and those are items 15A, Los Angeles County Department of Public Works, item 15B, again, Los Angeles County Department of Public Works, and item 15C, the Sadler application. Staff is recommending the commission vote and approve these items.
Move consent.
Moved by Commissioner Riley, seconded by Commissioner Wesel. They're asking for... Okay. Before I call the roll on this, I was just handed by Vice Chair Neely two speaker slips on C. I see you're both in favor of the project. Do you feel a need to speak at this time?
Just a brief statement.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Gwen Sadler. Good morning, Commission and staff. I just wanted to say thank you very much. We wanted to especially thank the staff members, Mr. James Johnson, Mr. Steve Hudson, for all their absolute professionalism and courtesy. It's been a long journey for us, and we just were very grateful and appreciative. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the kind comments, and you can come back anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. And with that, again, we have a motion by Commissioner Potter on the consent calendar, and second by Commissioner Wesel. They're asking for a yes vote. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the consent calendar is approved, those three items. Oh, Riley, I'm sorry. Thank you, Commissioner Riley.
The next item is item 14.5A, and this is can be found on the addendum to the agenda. And this is a request for extension of time to adopt the revised findings for the denial of the City of Oxnard Local Coastal Program Amendment 1-07. The Coastal Act requires the Commission to adopt findings to support its action rejecting an LCP amendment no later than 60 days after the date on which the action was taken. The Commission may extend this time limit for up to a period not to exceed 1 year. Staff is requesting an extension of the time limit in order to allow adequate time to prepare the revised findings supporting the Commission's action. The motion to extend the time limit can be found at the bottom of the page of the one-page staff report. And that concludes my presentation on this item.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ainsworth. Commissioners, for motion?
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Wan, seconded by Commissioner Akajian. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this time extension? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved, the time extension.
The next item is item 15E, and it's a silver application. Gary Tim, the district manager, will be presenting this item, and I would just like to let you know that Gary's a little under the weather and his voice is a little rough, yeah, so hopefully he can make it.
Mr. Ainsworth,
yes.
I've had a request. We're moving along very well here this morning, which we appreciate staff's help and everybody, but we're going to take a five-minute bio before we go into this one. Okay?
Would yes.
Be okay with the commissioners?
Thank you.
Let's call the meeting back to order, and with that, I will go back to Mr. Ainsworth, and we're at 15E, I believe, silver?
Yes. The next item is 15E, and Gary Tim, our district manager, will be presenting this item, but let me just say that Gary Tim's a little under the weather today, and he is losing his voice, so please bear with him, and if he runs into trouble here, I'll have to jump in and help out. He's a real trooper, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, he went on vacation, and he brought this back from Ireland. Can you imagine?
So I turn it over to Gary, and we have a PowerPoint for this one.
All right. Thank you. This is a de novo hearing for an appeal of a CDP approved by the City of Malibu for Kimberly and Arthur Silver for construction of an 11,158-square-foot partial two-story, 18- to 22-foot-high single-family residence with a 5,000-square-foot basement and garage, on-site wastewater treatment system, and 3,124 cubic yards of grading. The de novo hearing is a continuation of the hearing on this matter from its November meeting, at which the Commission previously found that the appeal raised substantial issue with respect to the project's consistency with the applicable visual resource protection policies of the City of Malibu certified LCP. The standard of review for the de novo hearing is whether the proposed development is in conformity with the certified City of Malibu LCP. During the de novo hearing, testimony may be taken from all interested persons, including the appellants in this case, Ron Goldman, Pat Healy, and the Malibu Coalition for Slow Growth. Let me make one minor change to the staff report. Staff is deleting our recommendation of special condition number 14, the indemnification condition, so we are eliminating that from our recommendation, and staff is now recommending approval of the proposed project with 13 special conditions, which can be found on pages 3 through 11 of the staff report. The project site is a 5.24-acre blufftop parcel located on the seaward side of Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu. There are blue water views from the highway across the site. The residence, as sited and designed, is located a minimum of 16 feet below the road grade of PCH at its highest point, although the majority of the development will be 17 to 21 feet below road grade. Oh, you got it? Is that it? The proposed structure and deck is located 180 feet and 140 feet, respectively, away from the coastal bluff in essentially the same footprint as the project previously approved by the Commission. Bluff setbacks exceed the 100-foot requirement established by the LCP. Prior to certification of the LCP, the Commission previously approved construction of a 9,400-square-foot, 18-foot-high, single-family residence along with slope remediation and drainage improvement work on the bluff face of the property in 1998. The permit was issued and the slope remediation and drainage improvements were completed, but the residence was never constructed. The major grounds for appeal of the project to the Commission concern consistency with the visual and scenic resource protection policies of the LCP, particularly related to views across the subject site from PCH to the ocean. Pacific Coast Highway is designated a scenic road in the LCP, and ocean views are protected. Where feasible, development is required to preserve blue water ocean views by limiting the overall height of structures to maintain ocean views over the structures. Regarding structure height and view corridors, the LCP implementation plan specifies that the maximum allowable height of structures shall be 18 feet above existing or finish grade, whichever is lower. The LCP specifies that where a project site on the ocean side of a public road, such as PCH, descends from the roadway, new structures shall not exceed one story in height as necessary to ensure blue water views are maintained over the entire site. However, where found appropriate through site plan review, the maximum height may be increased to 24 feet for flat roofs or 28 feet for pitched roofs above existing or finished grade, whichever is lower, so long as certain findings can be made. The proposed residence is primarily one story and 18 feet in height. However, a portion of the structure is two story and 22 feet in height with a flat roof. Approximately 72% of what is one story and 28% is two story in height. The structure is situated about 320 feet away from Pacific Coast Highway on a gently descending slope. The centerline elevation of PCH at the development area is approximately 163 feet above sea level. The one-story portion of the structure is 18 feet above finished grade and at an elevation that ranges between 142 and 146 feet. The highest roof elevation of the proposed residence, which is 22 feet above finished grade for the eastern two-story portion of the structure, is at an elevation of approximately 147 feet. Therefore, the one-story portion of the proposed residence is 17 to 21 feet below road grade, and the two-story portion is 16 feet below the road grade of PCH. Commission staff analyzed the potential impact on ocean views across the project site from PCH with the use of story poles. Slide 3 would be best for that. And a visual analysis submitted by the applicant. The city approved the two-story, 22-foot-high portion of the residence through site plan review by finding, pursuant to the Malibu LCP, that the project does not adversely affect neighborhood character, provides protection of public blue water views, and is consistent with the LCP. Commission staff reviewed the approved plans as well as story poles placed on the property to depict the height and location of the structure. Staff's review indicates that given that the top of the proposed development will be significantly below road grade, blue water ocean views would be maintained over the entire site. The proposed wooden trellis attached to the west side of the residence is 18 feet high and 15 feet wide. The trellis does not exceed the height or elevation of the residence nor pose a significant blue water view obstruction, in staff's opinion. The LCP further specifies that fences, walls, and landscaping shall not block views of scenic areas from scenic roads, parks, beaches, and other public view areas. Additionally, the LCP requires that the project site shall be landscaped with native vegetation types that have a maximum growth height at maturity that are located such that landscaping will not extend above road grade. The applicant subsequently submitted to commission staff a revised landscape plan for the proposed project site on March the 22nd to address the visual impact concerns. While the locations of the landscape planning remain the same, the revised landscape plan includes several changes regarding proposed tree species and size reduction of certain trees. The applicant proposes to further restrict 10 of the previously proposed maximum 18-foot tall trees that are located closest to Pacific Coast Highway to a maximum of 16 feet. In addition, the revised landscape plan specifies tree and shrub species that have a natural growth height range that does not exceed the maximum height proposed, with the exception of 6 tree species. The 6 tree species proposed may naturally surpass the maximum height proposed at maturity, but the applicant proposes to containerize these species in order to maintain the trees at the maximum height of 18 feet. Commission staff reviewed the revised landscaping plan and analyzed how the proposed landscaping would impact blue water views across the site. Commission staff visited the project site to view story poles that were placed by the applicant of a representative sample of proposed landscape trees on the site. The selected story pole trees are highlighted and numbered on the applicant's revised landscape plan, included as Exhibit 13 in your staff report. The story pole trees include 2 18-foot tall trees, number 3 and 4, located near the proposed residence, as well as 5 other trees located closer to Pacific Coast Highway and spread out across the property that are proposed to be no taller than 16 feet in height. Photographs of the story poles are included as Exhibit 12 in the report. As viewed from the story pole photographs in the staff site visit, the two-story pole 18-foot-high trees, number 3 and 4, appear to exceed the height of the 18-foot-tall portion of the proposed residence, yet remain in line with the 22-foot-tall portion. As such, additional blue water views beyond that of a majority of the residential structure, which is 18 feet high, may be obstructed. However, the 5 other story pole trees are 16 feet in height and do not obstruct additional blue water views beyond that of the residence. Since the site descends seaward from PCH, staff has determined that 18-foot tall vegetation nearest and at grade with the proposed residence would not exceed the height of the 18-foot-tall portion of the structure. All other vegetation upslope from the structure must progressively be reduced in height as the site ascends from the residence towards Pacific Coast Highway in order to maintain an unobstructed cone of vision for public views of the ocean. The Malibu LCP requires that new development, including landscaping, be sited and designed to preserve blue water ocean views. The LCP specifies that landscaping shall not extend above road grade at maximum growth height. It is important to note that this is the maximum standard, and in this case, that standard does not serve to preserve blue water ocean views or minimize impacts to scenic resources in some areas of the site. In order to preserve blue water views from PCH to the maximum feasible extent, staff recommends that all site landscaping, including trees, fencing, and walls, shall be limited in height and shall not block or adversely impact public views of the ocean from the highway, as detailed in Special Condition Number 5. Special Condition 5 requires that vegetation located south of the fire department turnaround driveway, indicated as Zone D on Exhibit 13, shall be limited to no more than 18 feet in height. Vegetation between the fire department turnaround driveway segment and a line 100 feet south of the property line at PCH, Zone C, as shown on Exhibit 13, that's also slide number 5, shall be limited to no more than 16 feet in height. Vegetation between 130 feet south of the property line at PCH, Zone B on Exhibit 13, shall be limited to no more than 12 feet in height, and vegetation within 30 feet of the property line at PCH, Zone A, shall not exceed road grade, except that ground cover that is no higher than 6 inches may be planted immediately adjacent to the property line at PCH. While most of the applicant's proposed tree species have a natural growth height range that does not exceed the maximum height allowed by the city, 6 trees would require containerization to ensure that they do not exceed the maximum 18-foot height limit. The applicant would like the option of using those tree species as well. While containerization may be suitable for species that have a natural height range that does not exceed the maximum allowable height, containerization can be problematic for species that naturally exceed the maximum height. Roots can break free from the container and continue to grow in ground, for instance. However, above-ground containerization of appropriate tree species can be a suitable environment for plant growth and would not likely exceed their allowable height. Therefore, to ensure that landscape plant materials proposed for the subject property can adequately maintain their allowable height in order to preserve blue water views, Special Condition 5 also specifies that all landscape vegetation must have a natural growth height range that does not exceed the specified maximum height at maturity, with the exception of appropriate containerized trees that shall be above ground and maintained to not exceed the specified maximum height for each landscape zone. To ensure that other landscape elements, such as fencing and walls near the property line, do not obstruct additional blue water views, Special Condition 5 requires that fencing and walls near the property line between PCH and the subject site shall be indicated on the revised final landscape plan and shall not exceed road grade. As condition to prepare and implement a revised landscaping plan consistent with the provisions described above, the landscaping of the site will maintain blue water views in staff's opinion, thereby minimizing impacts to visual resources from the scenic highway, consistent with the policies and provisions of the Malibu LCP. The addendum also includes a revision to Special Condition 12 regarding archaeological resource protection, which requires the monitoring archaeologist to report his or her determination or analysis of any resources that may be discovered during site grading to the executive director. The addendum includes a letter from Pat Healy and the Malibu Coalition for Slow Growth, dated May the 7th, which indicates support for the staff recommendation. If an additional requirement is added to Special Condition 5, the revised landscaping plan, to ensure protection of view corridors on the property and require conformance with components of the settlement agreement between the applicant and the City of Malibu regarding tree heights. The letter also requests that the Commission require elimination of the trellis from the project. As previously mentioned, the applicable LCP standard in this case is to preserve blue water ocean views over the project where the topography of the project site descends from the roadway, which is the case for the subject site. Side yard view corridors are only required by the LCP where site topography does not allow for siding structures below road grade and providing views over the project. Regardless, side yard setbacks, 84 feet on the west and 71 feet on the east, would exceed typical LCP requirements for view corridors. And Special Condition 5 restricts the height of all trees on the project site, including those in the side yards. Further, as mentioned previously, the Commission is not bound by or restricted by the settlement agreement between the applicant and the city, and it is not appropriate to refer to it in a special condition requirement. Also, the required future development deed restriction would apply to future landscaping as well. And that concludes the staff presentation at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Tim. Appreciate that. With that, I'll go to the commission for ex parties, and I'll start with Commissioner Akashian.
Mr. Chair, I had a conversation last Thursday with Susan McCabe in which she expressed her general concurrence with the staff recommendation, but did mention that at that time that she felt that any fencing would be allowed to exceed the height of the center line of the road as long as it was visually permeable, which she said was consistent with the Malibu LCP.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I spoke too fast. Mine is on file. My ex parties are on file.
Thank you, Commissioner Kaji.
Mr. Chair, I had a phone conversation with Susan McCabe last week, similar to Commissioner Potter's, and it's on file.
Yes, I also met with Susan McCabe in my office on May 4th. She explained the nature of the proposed development and described the problems that the Silvers Council had with the condition of indemnifying the Coastal Commission and some matters related to the fence as well.
Vice Chair Neely.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had a telephone conference with Susan McCabe on April 26, where she indicated they were basically in agreement with the staff recommendations except the condition regarding indemnification.
I also had a telephone conversation on April 27th with Susan McCabe and April Verbonik, and it was similar in content. They were concerned about the special condition 14, that it was something that was not acceptable, and also the fencing issue that was described by Commissioner Potter, and it's also on file.
My ex parte is on file. I did receive an email from Richard Scott. Today's Monday. I think Friday, in which he wanted to know if there was any issues that concerned me. I did not respond to the email.
Anybody else on this side? I would have been left out if I hadn't received a call from Susan McCabe, and I did twice. First one is Susan McCabe and April Verbonik, and it's on file, but they reviewed the history of the project and the landscaping conditions. They discussed Commissioner Wan's issues with the landscaping plan. They said that the staff responded by even further restricting the landscaping conditions. The applicants are in agreement with the staff recommendation with the exception of the indemnification condition. At the first call, they said they had strong objections to special condition 14. This ex parte, I think, is on file. But then I had a subsequent phone conversation with Susan McCabe where she went into some detail about their counsel's finding on special condition 14. And she outlined what was in a letter I received later, which had been copied to the other commissioners and the staff, which basically had five key points. Commission lacks authority to impose the condition. Cities and counties are different than the commission. The condition is bad policy and would have a chilling effect. The condition is discriminatory. And the condition would constitute an invalid underground regulation. She also pointed out the same identification condition is in Friday's 13 Item 13, Elliott, with the appellants listed as Roxane Warren, but an objection letter to the county from this same individual is on Sierra Club letterhead. With that, that was my second ex parte.
Thank you, Commissioner Blank. With that, okay, we'll go ahead and we'll open the public hearing. And first of all, recognize April Verbonik. And how much time, ma'am, are you requesting?
6 minutes should do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me first figure out if I can work this thing. Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is April Verbanek, and I'm the project manager for Arthur and Kimberly Silver. I'd first like to thank the Commission and staff for your time and consideration of this matter and staff's very diligent efforts in working with us to resolve this project and their careful analysis. The property owners wholly support the staff recommendation to approve the project and the staff report findings that the project is consistent with all applicable policies of the Malibu LCP, and the property owners are in agreement with all the recommended special conditions of approval. I'd like to briefly review the proposed project and a little bit of history with you, very similar to what Gary has gone over, but just a few things that I'd like to point out. The proposal is for a single-family residence on a blufftop lot located between Pacific Coast Highway and Malibu Road. And as Gary mentioned, it was subject to a coastal development permit approved by the Commission in 1998 for a residence, bluff remediation, and drainage. The remediation and drainage was installed by the previous property owner, but the residence was never built out. This is important to note because the landscaping plan and the tree plan that was approved pursuant to that 1998 coastal development permit was considered by the City of Malibu and was reflected in their decision to approve the landscaping and tree plan for the project before you now. I'd also like to note just briefly that these property owners are now in their seventh year of the planning and appeal process for this project, and so we're very hopeful that this will be the final step in the process with resulting in an approved coastal development permit today. There are three primary issues that have been addressed throughout the planning process. With regard to Blue Water View protection, there are several project elements that address this, including a grading plan that is designed to sink the proposed residence into the site. As staff has reviewed with you, the maximum height of the proposed residence is 22 and 18 feet in height, which will be located 16 feet and 17 to 22 feet below the road grade of Pacific Coast Highway. The proposed development clusters the development on site and provides side yards consisting of approximately 50% of the property width, where 25% is required by the LCP. The open air trellis is proposed at 18 feet in height and 15 feet from the west side of the residence. This would be constructed entirely of wood and is you can see right through it when you're viewing the property from Pacific Coast Highway. And then finally, pursuant to the staff recommendation, the landscaping will be well below the road grade of Pacific Coast Highway and will serve to protect blue water views across the entire property. With respect to geologic stability, again, as staff mentioned, the proposed residence and patio are 180 and 140 feet setback from the bluff top, respectively. All of the proposed development is located well landward of the established geotechnical setback line, and the consulting geologist and geotechnical engineer have found the project site to be grossly stable. And finally, with respect to drainage and water quality, the proposed project includes a state-of-the-art subterranean stormwater detention system that will capture and treat stormwater runoff from the proposed development, and it also includes an additional retention tank below ground that would capture and treat runoff from Pacific Coast Highway and properties to the north, which is currently discharged onto the property untreated. This is a slide of the city's photograph documentation of the certified story poles, and again, just reviewing that the proposed residence will be located well below the road grade of Pacific Coast Highway, which is what the LCP requires. 72% of that residence will be 17 to 20 feet below road grade, and the remainder 22-foot portion will be a minimum of 16 feet below road grade. The proposed project is also consistent with surrounding development and a number of projects that the Commission has approved adjacent to the property in the past. As you can see, we've got a number of residences located just down coast from the project site where the residences have been permitted at road grade or just slightly below road grade. So this project will actually protect more blue water views than what's been approved in this area in the past. This is a commercial development across the street from the property, has blue water views across the property, and just an additional slide to show neighborhood compatibility. As staff also provided some slides for you, I went ahead and prepared these slides so that you can see the story polling that we did out at the property to illustrate the 16-foot and 18-foot high tree locations. You can see that there are a number of trees that will be further reduced by the staff recommendation from 18 feet to 16 feet. Their concern being that some of those 18-foot high trees closer to Pacific Coast Highway could block blue water views, and the property owners are in agreement with that. And this is just another photograph illustrating those tree poles that we put up at the property, and again, pointing out those ones that would be reduced further to 16 feet in height. Upon receiving the staff recommendation to further reduce the landscaping closer to Pacific Coast Highway to 12 feet in height, we again went out and set up story poles. That zone would be established 30 feet to 100 feet seaward from Pacific Coast Highway, and you can see the staff recommendation for the landscaping will absolutely result in zero blue water view blockage on this property. This is an illustration of what's required by the LCP, which is the upper scaled cross section there. And as you can see, you know, the residents and the landscaping typically would be permitted up to the center line of Pacific Coast Highway. And what staff is recommending and what the applicants are proposing for this project far exceeds those requirements in providing protection of blue water views. I'd also like to note that.
Well, your time is up.
Time is up.
But
okay.
But I'm glad to grant you 2 or 3 minutes for rebuttal time if you'd like to use that for you or Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Why don't we grant you 3 minutes then, okay?
Okay.
And you can take it and rebuttal then.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Good morning. Stephen Kaufman for the applicants.
How much time, sir?
About 10 seconds. Because staff has deleted Special Condition 14, I have really nothing to offer.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. That's the best presentation we've gotten today. Thank you. And, okay, Ms. Healy, Pat Healy. And Ms. Healy, how much time are you requesting today, ma'am?
I don't think more than 3 minutes.
That's fine. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Pat Healy, and I'm representing the Malibu Coalition for Slow Growth. We don't believe there's any need to have the fencing above road grade. It can be downslope and still protect the owner's privacy. We know staff worked hard to get landscaping conditions, which the applicant found acceptable, rather than espousing the height restrictions in the staff report for the February meeting. The February recommendation was more protective of public ocean views because it restricted trees at maturity to a height not to exceed the roof line of the proposed residence at elevation 147, rather than to road grade, which is 16 feet higher, which is what staff is recommending today. If you want to be more protective of public views, the solution may be to say that the tree height at maturity will be the lower of the height set forth in 5A5 or elevation 147. We are requesting the following language be added as the last sentence of special condition 5A5. in lieu of the vegetation height limitation set forth in zones B, C, and D in the designated view corridors as set forth in the settlement agreement Exhibit A, no vegetation can block any ocean views except certain trees which cannot exceed 10 feet in height. These 10-foot trees are indicated in the landscape plan and the staff report and at Exhibit 13. We'd also like to add to this condition that no shrubs can be placed in the view corridors. This provision as a condition is necessary in order to guarantee protection of view corridors. One can't rely on just the landscape plan alone, otherwise over time it may get lost. It's necessary to inform successors in interest and to remind staff of the height limits in the view corridors later on when they're reviewing the final landscape plan. We just heard staff say that they can't include the settlement agreement as part of a condition, but certainly it could be used for as a reference point. The last point we'd like to make is that in addition to give truly meaningful meaningful western view corridor, we ask the commission to please eliminate from the proposed project the so-called trellis, since it is not a trellis. A trellis is defined under the LCP as a frame supporting open lattice work typically used for training vines. This structure's purpose is not to train vines. It's supporting many columns, which are huge. They're 4 feet in diameter, and the lattice roofing has overhang beams of 4 feet in depth. We believe this is actually a 16-square-foot plus outdoor living room and the equivalent in size to a small house, which is totally unnecessary and unnecessarily will further block ocean views. So please, we ask that you eliminate this from the site plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Healy, for coming today.
You're welcome.
With that, I'll go back to April Verbonik for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, again, the property owners are in agreement with all of the recommended special conditions for the project, but I would note that the staff is recommending that the fencing, the property fencing for the front yard, be located below the road grade of Pacific Coast Highway, even though the LCP specifically allows for permeable fencing to be located above that road grade. And so it's been a long process. They're willing to accept the condition, but I think it is contrary to the LCP. And that's all I have.
Well, thank you. Thank you. With that, I'll go back to Mr. Tim or Mr. Ainsworth, either one.
Thank you, Chair Kruger. Just a couple comments regarding the testimony of Pat Healy and her recommendation that trees be restricted even further in height within the side yard view corridors. I would again reiterate that the special condition that applies to tree heights across the property also applies to all vegetation in the side yard setbacks. View corridors are not specifically required in this case, since the standard is to protect views over the subject site. But in this case, the special condition number 5 does restrict the height within the side yard setbacks equally to the height restrictions elsewhere on the site. As far as Ms. Healy's recommendation that the trellis be eliminated from the project, I would point out that the side yard setbacks already exceed the LCP standards, and the trellis itself is also restricted to 18 feet. It's located in the same portion of the site as the house and will not exceed that height at all. That concludes the staff comments.
Mr. Chairman, just one additional comment relative to the elimination of the indemnification condition. I just wanted to expand on the reason that we did that. As you know, we have been attaching that condition in matters where we think the controversy may lead to litigation and potential exposure of this commission to attorney's fees and costs. So what we have done, though, we do this on a case-by-case basis, that when we do see that there that the controversy has been resolved to the extent that we have addressed any of the concerns that the opponents have raised, and we feel a level of confidence that we're not going to be looking at litigation here, we don't need that condition. So that's the reason that we eliminated that condition in this situation, because of the adjustments that we made through the other staff recommended conditions and the acceptance by the applicant of those conditions, and in conversations, of course, with the opponents.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas, for those comments. With that, I'll come back to the commission and go to Commissioner Juan first.
Yes. For those of you who are relatively new to the commission or unfamiliar with the situation in Malibu, if you drive through most of Malibu, frankly, you wouldn't know there was an ocean there, even though we all know it's there. You can't see it. And there are very few places left in Malibu where you can actually see the ocean. So wherever there is currently an ocean view, it's important to try to protect that for the public. In this case, I have to say that this has moved in the right direction. But it's important also to remember that the ocean views here are not based on the height level of PCH, because the horizon is well below the level of PCH. So when you hear all of this discussion about the heights and relative to PCH, PCH is not the standard. It's the overall standard in the LCP, but the concept behind the standard in the LCP, and I believe that's maximum in the LCP, is to protect the ocean view. So you have to be looking at this in terms of what is protective of the ocean view. I think that staff has basically done a good job on this. I don't have many problems. I just have one concern, and that's that when you put out selective story poles and you go to sort of interpret what that's going to mean eventually as to what the trees are going to do relative and the landscaping is going to do relative to the view, you get a general idea. But in the end, after it's all grown, then you can determine whether or not that's actually correct. And it seems to me that there needs to be, in addition to what is in there now, a general statement in the conditions that says that regardless of the specific limitations within the zones, that the intent of the conditions is so that there will be no additional blockage of the ocean views other than what is blocked by the house, because the house does block some of the ocean views. It's just that you can see over it. It's not that it's not blocking anything. So what I think the intent here all along is to make sure that as the landscaping grows and as it's put in, that it tapers off towards PCH and that it won't block any more views in addition to what the house blocks. And I think that intent has to be specified in the conditions so that it's clear that in the long run, this is what was meant. And as long as the landscaping doesn't block more than what the house blocks, then I don't think there's a problem here.
Thank you, Commissioner Juan. Commissioner Hueso.
Yes, I just have a question, just a clarification on the liability issue. Is it indisputed that the site may be subject to hazards from landslide and erosion as a result of the development?
Based on the geologic reports and the remediation work that's going to occur here and subdrain systems that are going to be applied, we believe that this site will be safe from geologic hazards, and there's a significant setback over and above what's required in the LCP here from the bluff edge. So we are confident that the development is designed to ensure geologic stability in this case.
Well, given that fact, we are still requiring that the property owner assume our risks to any, because I see there's an assumption of risk provision in the application. We are asking that they assume any or waive any claim of damage against the Coastal Commission as a result of any potential erosion.
That is correct. When we have a situation on these bluff bluff in close proximity to bluffs or geologically unstable areas, we typically do require that condition, the assumption of risk condition, as it's, I don't want to say standard special condition, but a typical special condition we require in these types of cases.
Can I supplement that response? The commission has a long history of dealing with the question of development in hazardous areas. The coast is a dynamic geographic place, and people have a tendency to build in harm's way because it's a beautiful place to be. What the commission has settled on over several decades now is, in lieu of all the other alternatives that we had tried over 20 years ago, which just didn't fly relative to issues such as should there be public subsidies or public support in case there is a disaster or a hazard that that we know about now and don't think is going to happen, but then it happens. So the assumption of the risk provision was adopted in large measure to provide notice to subsequent purchasers. It's kind of a consumer protection measure to indicate also that there is a risk on the particular property. We think that it's been addressed in terms of reasonable likelihood of a loss being reduced, but it nevertheless is a hazardous site just by the nature of its location. So that's why we use that provision.
So it'll become the property owner's responsibility in perpetuity to make sure that no erosion results from this.
Well, it'll be in their self best interest to do that, but this provision merely says that anybody who purchases the property is on notice that there is a hazardous condition. That's the primary purpose. The other is, of course, to make sure that there's no liability on the state, part of the state, for approving a permit, even though we don't think that would happen. But it's just assurance, additional assurance.
And with there are no additional provisions for indemnification other than this one in this application?
No, the indemnification provision is a separate provision, which we've now deleted from our recommendation. This is just a measure that deals with potential hazards and loss of property as a result of the hazard, whether it's fire or earth movement or whatever.
Okay, this is a very wise provision. I just want to call attention to it. Thank you.
Commissioner Cram?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk for a minute about, I know it was deleted, but special condition 14 here, the indemnification by the applicant. You know, Director Douglas, you indicated that this is added and deleted on a case-by-case basis based on the perceived threat of litigation or...
you need to speak into your mic, Commissioner Cram.
Perceived threat of litigation. I think this raises larger policy issues and would like to discuss. I don't know if this is the time you want to do it or under the commissioner comments section. I don't know how the other commissioners feel.
Yes, I think it's a legitimate issue even right now, or we can do it under commissioner comments. I think since it's been brought up and we've discussed it here, it is a very important issue, I think.
Right. So I wonder if Director Douglas could give us sort of a history of, you know, where this has been used, the rationale, legislative support, court decision support for this, and any, because I'm troubled by it.
Well, I think as I've reported to the commission before, and as several commissioners have indicated, local governments use an indemnification provision routinely. The commission has experienced a situation where you have, in fact, several, where the commission has taken action on approving a particular project, which opponents felt was contrary to law. The result was that you were sued and in litigation and lost the litigation, and then the commission was faced with attorney's fees costs, which come directly out of our budget, which we haven't budgeted for, and which have created significant funding problems for us in terms of an agency that's not adequately funded in the first place. So I felt very strongly after a few experiences like this that we need to follow the example of local government, and the responsible thing to do is to provide insurance that if in fact there is litigation and the commission is exposed to costs as a result of that, that the applicant, who's the one that really persuaded the commission to take a position that may not be consistent with the law as viewed by opponents, that they bear the cost of the consequences of the litigation.
Going to what you said, Director Douglas, I'm troubled by divorcing our responsibility to do what we think is right by the financial consequences of that. And what we're really saying is, you know, if the applicant convinces us to do something that turns out we get litigation over, they should be responsible for that. But I feel as though we should be responsible for that, and not having us as commissioners and our concern and well-being about the Coastal Act and the Coastal Commission being at stake and paying the financial penalty when we are wrong. I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, and this may be a broader discussion for a different context.
Well, let me try to say this. I think this is a very important discussion. I know all the commissioners will weigh in on either side of it, but I, as one of the commissioners, too, share some grave concern that sometimes this type of policy, we should discuss it thoroughly because it might invite lawsuits and be really detrimental to smaller applicants and applicants that cannot ill afford and may come out to be a de facto, they can't go forward. Or this condition becomes, I could see if I was coming in for a house application and I had a neighbor, not in my backyard, not in my side yard, etc., and they were forced by this commission to indemnify for all legal, etc. A lot of people cannot afford to do that. And so we need to, I think, I for one would, and I'd like to hear from my colleagues, we maybe not at this particular item that's come up now, because this has been eliminated from this particular item, and we can take this item up right now, but maybe either under commissioner comments or at another time, I would like to have this discussion if it's okay with my colleagues.
I would suggest you do that under later on when we get
the commissioner comments, if that's okay.
Reports, and we can discuss it then.
We'll do that. Is that okay with you, Commissioner Cram?
Yeah, I think that was my initial question. If you wanted to deal with it now or deal with it under,
we'll do with it. I didn't know.
We'll do with it later. That's fine.
Okay, Commissioner Kashian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question to our staff. Question about the fencing. If it's contrary to LCP, why are we recommending it?
It's not contrary to the LCP.
With regard to the fencing, the intent here is to minimize the visual impacts of development from as seen from PCH. In this case, we felt it was important to avoid the impact entirely by locating that fence just below grade. And it's feasible here. There's a lot of area there. And so we felt that that was appropriate here, and it minimizes the visual impact of the fencing, because the fencing along PCH does result in a visual impact. And we really do not believe that that is inconsistent with the LCP. In fact, we think it is consistent with the LCP.
Commissioner Kashian,
I'm a little confused when you say it is consistent, but yet it's contrary.
It allows, the LCP allows for fencing along PCH that is visually permeable, where there's no other alternative. You have to look at the alternatives that is least, impactful, I guess is the word.
The point is that just because the applicant says it's inconsistent with the LCP doesn't mean it's inconsistent with the LCP. We don't think it is inconsistent. We think the LCP requires us to, where it is feasible, to minimize the visual intrusion of fences. And here it's feasible to put it down lower, and we think that's consistent with the LCP.
Thank you for that. Vice Chair Neely?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Number A-4-MAL-06-096 pursuant to the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Been moved by Commissioner Neely, seconded by Commissioner Riley. They're recommending the maker and seconder a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as conditioned and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Yes. Commissioner Wan?
Yeah, I think since staff didn't get back to the issue that I raised, that I'll probably have to do this by an amending motion. So I'm going to amend it as follows. A statement that the heights specified in the various planting zones are maximum heights, and the intent is that there be no blockage by the plantings of ocean views beyond that which is blocked by the house. And I think that that takes care of my concern about whether you can or can't tell just what will happen after everything starts to grow. So if I can get a
second. It's been moved by Commissioner Wan and seconded by Commissioner Schallenberger on the amending motion. Does everybody understand it?
Question?
Yes, Commissioner Riley.
When we're saying none of the landscaping can block anything that's not already blocked by the house, my understanding is there's landscaping to the side of the house that isn't a greater height, but is certainly blocking something that isn't blocked by the house.
Okay. I didn't know how to put this.
Well, I don't either.
Okay. But I understand what you're saying. As long as the blockage, and I don't care if it's across the site, is what you're talking about in the side areas, okay? As long, because what we're facing, if you look at the letter that came in from Ron Goldman, what we're facing here is the question of the heights. As long as it's not a, and the problem is how you express it, because you've got a downslope here, is that it doesn't block across, maybe I can add to that, the height across the site. Would that deal with your question, Commissioner Riley? Staff, do you understand? Maybe you can help me with what
yes,
the language ought to be. I think
yes,
you understand
we,
what
yeah,
I'm
do you
intending.
Understand what, you, what the intent here is?
Right.
And the intent is to create the height that will not be any higher than the residents across the entire site. So it will not exceed the height of the residence across the
yeah, site. And a cap so that the view, it's not just the height, because if you put that height, that 18 feet or that 22 feet at PCH, obviously you're blocking all the views. It's that the view across the site capped at that level.
Yes, you have to understand that the vegetation up closer to PCH it's going
to
be a little higher than the home, but it's a cone of vision, so
right.
It appears to be low. I mean, it won't be blocking any views over and above what's there.
Okay,
for
and
the
that
house.
And if you can figure out what that language would be, that's the intent of it, Commissioner Riley.
Mr. Riley.
Well, I thought I heard Gary Tim basically address that as a staff condition in terms of the graduated height that would be allowed for the vegetation. I thought staff had address that issue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I believe the concern here is that some trees, regardless of the specified height limit, that either weren't demonstrated by story poles or because their growth may exceed the natural height, or by containerization may be trees that would exceed the natural height. The intent, I believe, of Commissioner Wan's motion is to state that regardless of the allowed heights of landscaping vegetation specified in any of the particular zones, A through D, no planting shall result in additional view blockage of the ocean over what the home itself blocks or the structure itself blocks from PCH. Now, we believe Special Condition 5 addresses that. Mm-hmm. And we have allowed, the only tree, as I indicated, we did allow, I believe, six tree species that don't have a maximum height range that would be within the range specified to be containerized above ground where they can be maintained. So, we believe the commission or this the recommended condition does accomplish that objective. But.
Well, in that case, would you incorporate the aspect that I'm talking about? And the reason I'm concerned and feel it needs to be this is that I don't want there to be a misunderstanding that because, and you, they put up, you know, a few story poles, and they put up, I don't know, quite a few, but they didn't put up every single tree on there, and it's hard to know in the future. I just don't want it to be confused in the future that because based on this simulation, you have these zones, and we believe that it won't block more, that in fact, if in fact it does, that it's clear that that's the principal intent here, and that's the principal issue, not necessarily what the simulations are. And I just want, there is a sentence in five, in condition five that says it, but I think it needs to be clarified, and that's all I'm talking about here, is to make sure that that intent is the overarching basis of the condition. That's what I'm saying. So if staff feels that that's the case, if they can incorporate it, that would be fine. Otherwise, I'll have to go with my amending motion.
Okay. Because I for one, thought it was taken care of. My interpretation with staff, you know, basically covered that. But with this amending motion on the table, the one amending motion, I'd like to ask the applicant before we vote on this, so we are very clear on the issue, and give you a chance to address this issue that Commissioner Wan's amendment takes on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We believe that the staff recommended condition addresses this. It establishes zones with maximum allowable heights across the entire width of the property depending on the topography and where it's at in relation to the residence. So our only concern would be what the intent of the amended motion is, in that we are proposing some landscaping in the side yard setbacks. It is restricted by the city's conditions of approval and further restricted by the staff recommended condition. And in some cases, there might be little snippets of additional blue water views that might be blocked by that vegetation, but the intent of the LCP is to preserve blue water views across the entire portion of the property, in which case the proposed project, as conditioned by staff, will do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Commissioner Wan, do you still like to go forward with your amending motion?
Well, let me ask staff a question, and then I'll answer it. Staff, is it clear enough that is the intent, and that if it should turn out, and I'm not talking about a few snippets, obviously, but if it turns out that the simulations were incorrect, would there be, and that we get significant view blockage in addition to what we anticipated, would that be, and I don't know that you would ever want to go to enforcement over this, but if there was an argument about it, would it be clear as to whether or not that was an issue if they met the conditions of the specific heights?
Yes, we believe, as written with those zones, that there will not be significant view blockage here. The intent behind that is to ensure that there won't be any view blockage over and above what's there for the house and along the sides of that 18-foot high, at least at grade with the house. So we do believe that we'll be able to enforce that.
That was the word. That's what I needed to know. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Okay,
Mr. Chair, I would like to make an amendment to the motion to allow the fence to exceed in height the center line of the road as long as it is permeable and compatible to the neighborhood.
Second.
Been moved by Commissioner Akajian and seconded by Commissioner Potter. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Akajian, your amending motion?
My understanding that it is in accordance to the LCP and does provide more security and does not create a blockage to the view of the blue water.
Commissioner Potter?
I think Gotcha has articulated my concern that is, if it is truly permeable, then it will not block the views. And so I see no harm in the motion, actually. I think it makes sense and is consistent. So for that reason, I'll support it.
Commissioner Wan?
Well, not to disagree with you, Commissioner Hagajian, but it is the staff's condition is consistent with the LCP, because the intent of the LCP, when you say that, for example, something is permitted, it doesn't mean that it has to happen. You are still have the intent of protecting views, and any fencing there is going to interfere to some degree with the views. Even if it's permeable, it's still a visual impact. And I should point out that the house is 320 feet from PCH, so there's really no reason why the fencing has to be right up at the level of PCH and create that problem. The minute it goes down just a few feet because the hill slopes, you wouldn't have that problem. And so I don't understand why there should be that need for that fencing like that. And I can't support the motion.
Vice Chair Neely.
Yeah, is the amending motion consistent with the LCP?
We don't think so, because it's feasible to put the fence lower to minimize the visual intrusion of the fence. So we don't think that would be consistent. If it were not feasible to put the fence down off the level of the highway, then it would be consistent to put it up there. But since there is enough room to do that, we think the amending motion would not be consistent with the LCP.
Okay, before we vote on that, and I'll go to other commissioners, I'd like to ask Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stephen Kaufman for the applicants. There is no issue of feasibility in this LCP, and I think maybe just would serve to read it to you. I'm looking at Section 6.5E dealing with ocean views. And it says, new development on parcels located on the ocean side of public roads, including but not limited to PCH, Malibu Road, Broad Beach Road, etc., shall protect public ocean views. One, where the topography of the project site descends from the roadway, new development shall be sited and designed to preserve blue water views, ocean views, over the approved structures by incorporating the following measures. C, and this is the operative provision, fences shall be located away from the road edge, and fences or walls shall be no higher than the adjacent road grade, with the exception of fences that are composed of visually permeable design and materials, period.
Thank you. Commissioner Lowenthal?
I just had a question for staff. My understanding with the applicant's first testimony was that there was no objection to the staff recommendation. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Any other commissioners before we call the roll on the amending? Commissioner Wan again?
Just one quick thing on this question of consistency with the LCP. I don't have the whole LCP in front of me, and you always have to read any policy. You can read it, but you have to read it in the context of every other policy in the LCP, and I have to go with what staff is saying.
Commissioner Kerr?
Yes, Commissioner Blank. I'm sorry.
So now I'm confused. I think Commissioner Lowenthal just raised a great point. Are the applicants in agreement with the staff report, or are the applicants in agreement with the staff report and the proposed amendment?
Well, it's our understanding that the applicant was in agreement with the staff recommendations. I think what they've raised is, gee, if they could have the fence in a different location, they would. But if you're going to adopt the staff recommendation, they're okay with that. And I'm sure you'll hear either confirmation or disagreement with my characterization.
Yes, I concur. The property owners, it's been a long road, and they would really love to have an approved CDP today, so they are willing to accept the staff recommendation. They would like to have their fencing at their property line like everybody else on Pacific Coast Highway, but they really just request the commission's support of this coastal development permit today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Verbani.
Okay.
Let's call for the question. Roll call vote, please. The maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote.
Commissioner Blank?
Yes.
Commissioner Burke?
No.
Commissioner Lowenthal?
No.
Commissioner Wessel?
Yes.
Commissioner Cram?
No.
Commissioner Neely?
No.
Commissioner Riley?
No.
Commissioner Schallenberger?
No.
Commissioner Wan?
No.
Commissioner Potter?
Aye.
Commissioner Oshajian?
Aye.
Chair Krewer?
No.
It fails.
3-9.
Okay. And with that, we'll go to the main motion. It's been made and seconded, and they're asking for a yes vote. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved.
That thank you. Completes the those items of the agenda. We will need a brief closed session today, and I would suggest that we do that after we go through the statewide matters. That's all right with you.
That is good, because otherwise we'd have to have a very long one tomorrow, closed session.
Let's
take use of this time and do it.
We don't have any minutes to approve today. Are there any commissioner reports? And if you'd like to discuss any of the issues that were previously raised, this would be the time.
We'll do it. First, I want to go to Commissioner Wessel. Commissioner Wessel?
Thank you. I just wanted to bring to everybody's attention, now that it's budget season, it's very important that we communicate some matters that might be important to the Coastal Commissioners in regards to future funding. We have sent a letter to the Speaker of the Assembly just requesting more funding for local coastal programs throughout the state through a grants program, and it's very important that we get a very consistent program across our state and that we have adequate planning within our with each community in the state. We've also asked for more funding for enforcement of making sure the properties are staying consistent with their promise to maintain the properties within certain codes enacted by the Coastal Commission. And there were a few other provisions that are very important that we hope people can chime in on, including maybe giving us more staff to become more efficient. And in my own interest of learning more about the Coastal Commission, the staff, and the processes, I've requested to Director Douglas that we sit down and talk about the applicant process in terms of what the average applicant goes through in terms of applying for a permit. It's very important that we have also a very consistent process. I just want to learn more about it and make sure I personally understand what the process is, and make sure that it's not only comprehensive and but also efficient, making sure that every applicant that comes through the coast has a very straightforward and honest set for, system of processes that they can approach. So we'll be going through that, and hopefully I can in my experience in creating efficiencies within the city of San Diego, probably maybe a report back in terms of my own experience with staff here. So far, my experience has been very favorable. The staff reports are very, very comprehensive, very thorough, and I just want to acknowledge the staff's done a very, very good job on a lot of these reports, and they've been very helpful in helping me to make my decision. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to personally thank Commissioner Hueso for his support. He did meet with the Speaker and brought these budget issues to his attention, and I really appreciate his working with Susan Hanch of your staff to focus in on those issues that we've brought to the attention of the budget subcommittees. Now the Speaker's alerted to it, and hopefully we'll have his support for those augmentations that we're supporting.
Great. Thank you, Director Douglas. Commissioner Cram, and then Commissioner Schallenberger.
We ought to continue the conversation about the indemnification issue. You know, I feel it's a big issue that we should not include these indemnifications in our findings, and I don't know how everyone else feels.
Commissioner Wan?
Well, I think you don't include them all the time, obviously, but there are occasions, and speaking from experience over the years, where applicants and their agents really push this commission hard to do things that, for example, are not consistent. They're not consistent with what the staff recommends, and they're not consistent with the Coastal Act. And it's naive to think that, well, as long as commissioners have made the decision based on whatever the reason is, that therefore the applicant shouldn't bear any of the costs. I think that's unreasonable from the commission's perspective. There have been a number of times where what has happened is that that applicants push, they got through what they wanted, and this commission got sued, and this commission lost. And I think we do need to take that into consideration given our budget situation.
I would just hate to be in a situation where we have a special interest group or someone who pushes something through and we don't take responsibility for it. You know, we're saying we approved something and we were wrong to do it, and now have enforcement of that really being directed by some outside third party who's going to bring an action like a developer against us, and the applicant is paying for it. Maybe the applicant isn't, you know, in a position to.
Well, I think it is problematic. I think if you're going to do it, you really should do it on a very limited basis, because I think it's very difficult at times. I can remember over all the years that where I've been an applicant, and I can tell you I did not indemnify for people taking action on things, but I think the reason is that government makes decisions, and some cities and things do ask for that today, but you've got to be very careful with that process, because what it does, it invites lawsuits. It invites people not to be responsible. I can remember years back when I've been at hearings before where people, it came out later that the actual planning commission or something that didn't get their way turned around and invited in lawsuits and then wanted to be indemnified in protection for those cities, etc. That kind of conduct is not something that's reasonable and rational. And that does happen. And so I, for one person, I think over the many years of experience, it's very, very bad policy to give broad indemnities against people who have property rights and have a house or project, etc., and say, well, it's their place, they're getting permitted, so they should bear all the responsibility of government that they pay taxes and everything for, and they should, regardless of how big or small they are, they should pay all the attorneys for all the attorneys who want to file something, and some of these suits are very frivolous, and it breaks them in the process. So, I think it's a very, very, should be used very limitedly. And I'd like to hear from other commissioners on this subject.
Sorry.
Commissioner Akajian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to staff. When we talk about funding, is it the funding from Coastal Commission's budget, or is it funding from Attorney General's budget?
No, it's if the commission, and I want to clarify, what happens is that if there is a lawsuit against the commission brought by somebody who's challenging a decision that you made, it goes to court, and a judge has to make a decision. And if there is a decision against the commission and that decision is not appealed or overturned on appeal, we are facing the potential of attorney's fees.
That's
when,
my question.
And when the court rules that there are attorney's fees that need to be paid, it comes out of the commission's budget, not the attorney general's budget, but out of the commission's budget. If it is of a size that we simply don't have the resources to pay, we would have to either lay off staff or cut elements of the program that are vital to the commission. We have, on occasion, gone to the legislature and asked for a supplemental appropriation. The legislature does not automatically do that. The legislature will be asking questions. Are you doing everything you can to reduce exposure to the taxpayers of this liability to the state? Sometimes they've given us the supplemental appropriations so we don't have to take it directly out of our budget. Sometimes they haven't. My concern is that because our budget is directly exposed in these limited cases, and I agree with the chair that this has to be very carefully applied, I think it's my responsibility as your executive director to recommend a course of action that really does minimize your exposure to your budget being reduced to a point where it really impairs the ability to do what the law requires us to do. So that's why we started this, and as I say, we are doing this on a very selective basis, and we will be very careful on it. But I think it is our responsibility to do that, and if the commission were to take a policy, for example, that we should not be requiring this in those circumstances that warrant it, I think we're going to have a hard time if we lose to justify to the legislature that we need a supplemental appropriation to cover that. And then I don't know what we do if it comes out of our budget. So that's where I'm coming from on this.
Commissioner Burke and Commissioner Riley.
Next week, when my second term comes to an end, I will have seen two things for sure in the 5 or 6 years I've been around here. One is I've never seen a minority applicant in 5 or 6 years. Never. The second thing is I've never seen a poor applicant in 5 or 6 years. That being said, I think government's got to take the responsibility. I don't think that it becomes a budget issue. If we make the decision, whether we make that decision based on pressure from agents or our conscience, we should be responsible for that decision because that's government's responsibility. Now, you know, if you want to, who... And everybody knows I like Peter, so this is not a slam on Peter. But God did not give Peter the divine insight to know where all of these cases should be applied with indemnity or not. Now, there are times where I think he does have divine insight. But in this particular case, it would be hardly strange. Okay? So that's all I got to say about that.
Thank you, Commissioner Burke. Commissioner Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's been pointed out previously that it's this is a practice that is fairly common and widely used by local governments, cities and counties, on discretionary permits that come through. We're kind of talking back and forth here about whether it's the right thing to do or not. I think another issue is whether we're confident that we have a legal authority to do it, and whether the Coastal Act provides the same kind of legal authority that local governments have under Subdivision Map Act. And so if we're going to continue this discussion at some point, I'd be interested in getting some clarification on that point, and maybe the only way we get clarification on that point is, you know, is to go ahead and do this and have it show up in court someday and have somebody in a black robe tell us whether it's legal or not. But if we have a, you know, I'd like to know what the legal basis is that we're asserting that we have this authority, because I think that's been questioned by Mr. Kaufman. Second thing is I would disagree with some of my colleagues about limiting the application of this. I think if you're going to do it at all, you ought to do it across the board. It ought to be a standard condition. It should be applied to every discretionary permit that comes before us. And that way it's equal across the board. I don't think we should be picking and choosing which applications we use that. Either we should use it on all of them, we shouldn't use it on any of them. And in terms of how it might influence the proclivity of lawsuits, that's a very interesting question on a number of levels for me. And I'd like to have, if we do continue this discussion, I'd like to have staff go back a few years, and of the times we've been sued, to sort of separate that into two categories. One is situations where the commission actually adopted the staff recommendation and conditions, and the other categories where the commission modified the staff recommendations or conditions, and what the outcomes were on those particular cases. I'd like to take a look at that in terms of, you know, being able to assess whether we're putting ourselves more at risk for legal action or less at risk for legal action. I think that would be information, one, that we haven't gotten before, and two, that would be informative on this issue.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley. Commissioner Schallenberger.
Commissioner Riley brought up most of the points I wanted to raise, and the only other one is that it strikes me, I'm looking at the letter that we received in our package dated May 3rd from Richards Watson and
Pearson,
signed by Stephen Kaufman. And they bring up a number of issues, all of which, if we continue this discussion, need to be addressed. We started off on whether it was good policy or not. It strikes me that the question of whether it's an underground regulation or whether it's discriminatory is a catch-22. Either we apply it all the time and it becomes an underground regulation, or we apply it in certain cases and not others, in which case it clearly isn't an underground regulation but may be discriminatory. So, again, that's something that I would like legal staff to look at and come back with their analysis on, if assuming we continue this discussion.
Mr. Chairman, relative to the legal question, legal staff is preparing a discussion for you because we knew this was going to come up. We wouldn't be recommending this if we didn't think it was legal. And but I do, and I have had discussions with both your staff counsel and the Attorney General's office, as have some of you. And so we will come back and give you a discussion in terms of the legal background. I think it's important to understand that there are distinctions relative to, for example, the limitation on local governments in using the indemnification clause. We don't see that as an authorization. We see it as a limitation on an inherent power that local government has, and we also think that the commission has that. But I think it's important for legal counsel to lay out some of those arguments for you at a subsequent meeting. They're not prepared to do that today.
Thank you, Director Douglas. Commissioner Lowenthal? Okay, thank you. Commissioner Cram?
No, Commissioner Blank.
No, Commissioner Blank?
I'll go after Commissioner Lowenthal. It's okay.
Thank you very much. The question I have probably has more to do with how new I am, and so please bear with me. But in more than whether we are legally able to do it or not, my concern is we are authorized by the legislature, as the state government, and my concern is more with our lack of confidence that our actions are defensible and should be defended by the government. And so if we were a municipal body, we would have the defense and access to the legal defense of our local city attorney or city prosecutor. And I'm really more concerned with that, is that we feel that our personal budget is at risk. And if that is the tone and tenor of the legislature, I think that's where our work needs to be, is to ensure that our actions are defensible at all times. Otherwise, I think it undermines our authority. And I don't. I'm hearing that we don't have that confidence. And that troubles me more than anything else we've discussed.
If I may, Commissioner, if I can respond to that. First of all, you should know that the defense of the commission's action by the Attorney General's office has been outstanding over the years. The record of success by your litigating counsel is really remarkable. It's just in those few cases where the commission's action is overturned by a court, whether it's trial court or court on appeal, those are the situations that we're concerned about. there used to be historically kind of a standard approach by the legislature of putting in a bill at the end of the year that would provide supplemental appropriations to agencies for litigation costs when they lose litigation, whether it's the Department of Corrections or Caltrans or the Coastal Commission or others. That no longer is the way that the legislature deals with that. And we have had to, over the last few years, when we have asked the legislature for a supplemental appropriation to cover the loss of a decision in court where a court has directed attorney's fees be paid, we have had to take that in on a specific case-by-case basis. And the legislature has been very demanding in terms of understanding why we're asking for that and what the basis was for the decision in the first place and whether we've done everything we can to reduce the exposure of the taxpayers to a general fund hit on the budget. So the defensibility of the decisions, I think the record of the commission is outstanding on that. But every now and then, there's a decision that's made and a court disagrees with the conclusion of the commission. And it's those cases that I'm really focusing on.
Commissioner Weiss. I got on the lights first and you recognized me last.
Well, everybody's got their light.
All right. I just in terms of the rationale for applying it to this particular case, I disagreed that just because somebody is out there willing to file a lawsuit for whatever reason is no really cause for us to require indemnification. I know that indemnification is required when a building is designed to a certain in a certain way that may impede with transportation, or it's a project that may handle hazardous substances that could potentially be of concern to the neighboring communities. I don't know that on single family residences that we should apply that. I think the provisions that you applied were very, very good. I think they addressed a potential problem that I think is of concern, and I think it was appropriate. I think that this issue, I think, goes to a bigger issue. We don't operate like a local government that can raise revenues, that can charge fees, that has a regular budget in terms of that they control. We cannot sit here and bond. We can't sit here and charge taxes. But we're a state agency, and I think that there should be some. There should be an understanding between the state, the legislators, and our organization that because we are a state agency, that they should indemnify us should we lose a case and it should exceed our budget. I don't think under any circumstances should we ever have to dip into our own budget to pay for lawsuits. And maybe that's something that we have to address at the state level, to get the legislators to recognize that our budget is not subject to being used to pay court settlements or any other impact that's not set forth within the provisions of why that money was allocated. If it was allocated to fund processing and staff costs and transportation, it should only be allowable to be spent on those items. If we lose a court case, it should not be taken away from those issues. And we need to get the state to acknowledge that either through a bill or through a memorandum of understanding or some formal process.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Blank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In hearing all of this discussion, it dawns on me that the comments are falling into two buckets, and I want to start a third one. The first bucket is the impact of this indemnification clause on applicants. And I think many of my fellow commissioners have raised those issues pretty clearly, and I think Mr. Kaufman's letter And this applicant did that as well. I'm not going to discuss that, at least for now. Maybe someone else will. The other one is the staff's comments about financial exposure to the commission itself. And I think those are valid, and I think this clause is an attempt to solve that problem. But unfortunately, this clause creates a third category, which I've not heard anybody discuss, and I want to, and I believe it's completely unintentional, but I really want all of us to think about what this does to the authority of the commissioners, not the commission, but the commissioners. I think there's four problems with this clause. For the first time, it makes decisions and wishes of the commissioners secondary to the recommendations that the staff makes. Second, the lack of financial consequences means that staff's interests may no longer be aligned with commissioners' interests. Third, because it eliminates financial impacts to the commission, it encourages third-party organizations to become the de facto enforcement arm of the Coastal Commission. And fourth, it now means that the staff has no financial interest in defending its own recommendations. So I could go into some more detail, but briefly, let me just point out that the Coastal Act envisions there will be times that the commissioners disagree with the staff recommendations. That's why we have commissioners, and the staff reports go to them at these hearings. One of the examples that have been raised to me as a indemnification reason was the Davenport barn decision, which I think, given how fast turnover on the commissioners are, there's only three commissioners left on this panel that participated in. But I went back and actually read the substantial issue hearing, the de novo hearing, and then the revised findings. And I also went back and read the Superior Court decision in its hearing, and then the fee and litigation cost hearing from the Superior Court. And basically, what happened was the staff recommended denial. The commission at its time, for whatever wisdom, said, no, we think this ought to be a approval. Staff had to come back and rewrite the findings to support the commission's decision. The Sierra Club sued and said the staff's findings were insufficient to support that decision. And in fact, that's exactly why we lost the case. Not because we did anything illegal, but let me read you just a small piece of the judge's ruling. On page 2, it said, after reviewing the pertinent provisions of the Coastal Act and the Santa Cruz LCP, the court determines that in approving the project, the commission failed in part to adopt adequate findings and to present adequate analysis to support its permit decision. And then later on it says, in the analysis section, despite the fact that the commissioners discussed with staff some of its desired revisions to the initial staff report, the revised final report as approved by the commission contains findings that appear to contradict the commissioner's decision. We lost this case because we didn't provide adequate findings. If, in fact, we now say that there's no legal consequence anymore for the commission to provide adequate findings to support commissioners' decisions and support applicants, we've just removed the authority of the commissioners to disagree with the staff. And I know that's not the intention of this clause, but I won't spend much more time in talking about this now, but I think this is a case where the cure will kill the patient. I believe that there are great reasons to want to protect the commission from financial pain. I support the staff's high-level goal of doing that, and I think this clause is absolutely amicable to the spirit of the Coastal Act, and I could not imagine going back to any of our appointing authorities and say we've given up that authority as commissioners. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Blank.
Mr. Chairman, this seems to have been coming up, this clause, in the last 6 months, and I know we've had lots of comment and discussion on it. I know Director Douglas has mentioned we've used it in the past. I think Mr. Kaufman has pointed out we've used it in the past in areas that utilize a public resource, and in the last 6 months it's been coming up now for single-family homes. I think we need a committee of the commission to actually go work with staff and figure out whether we could come up with a different method, whether we could do it administratively with staff or whether we need to seek regulation or even legislation to protect the commission, but not with this language. So I'd like to move we appoint a committee of the commission to look at this. Have a second? Anybody?
Yeah.
Well, no. It's not agendized, so my suggestion is we put that on as an action item for next month and move on it.
Yeah. I think that's what we need to do. Commissioner Riley's correct.
Correct.
We need to put it down for an agenda item for next month. Commissioner Cramp? Yeah. Commissioner Juan?
Just very quickly, Commissioner Blank, aside from all of the other issues, having been here for the Davenport hearing, I'm going to take a little bit of exception as to your interpretation of the history of what happened in that case. And we can discuss it in another time. I don't want to go into it in the hearing. But the reason the findings weren't adequate to support the commission's decision is because the commissioners didn't specify what their reasons were for taking the positions that they did.
Well, Mr. Chair, having also been here, I would simply submit that I think that Commissioner Blank's analysis was exactly right on for what happened.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, I would concur wholeheartedly with Mr. Riley's recollection.
The funny part was, I think I was there. And I think I agree with everybody on this one. So it's been a long time ago, that hearing. Yeah. So, Commissioner Schallenberger, did you have something? Yes, ma'am.
I do. I am just so pleased to report to you all that the Roads Edge Committee has had a very successful meeting. We've been at this for 2 years. It's been very slow and lumbering and very careful step by step. But for those of you who don't know, because it has been going on a while, our charge was to work with Caltrans to come up with kind of a palette for bridge railings and guardrails and barriers along the side of the road in the coastal zone. So the biggest news, seriously, is that we as a committee anyway, a task force, whatever we're called, have reached agreement on the design for a 10-mile bridge. So this will come back to the commission, and I have renderings of it here. If anybody wants to look at it after we break, I'd be glad to share. And I really hope you agree with us, because I wouldn't wish any of you, or much less the commission as a whole, to have to go through our design talking about it. So I, as maybe staff knows, I think that comes back to us in the fall, maybe when we're in Eureka, I'm not sure. In addition, in order to be sure that this doesn't have to happen again this way, Caltrans and Coastal Commission staff are working on something that will go up on the web page, which is called a reference guide for transportation projects in the coastal zone. And it will include kind of a number of palettes of different kinds of railings and barriers and Caltrans, of course, you know, their main concern is about safety, and they also care about aesthetics. But truthfully, when we kind of left the safety to them, and the Coastal Commission side has cared a great deal about aesthetics and being compatible with the scenic nature of the coastal zone and the historic bridges, that kind of thing. So, so that is happening. And then the other thing is that Caltrans is going out for a grant to try and do research on the required rail heights to be safe for bicyclists. And we've spent an inordinate amount of time on the details of that study, whether you need to have a bicyclist going 70 miles an hour coming down a hill and hitting a 45-degree angle, whether that's essential to be part of the study or not. So it's been a lot of fun, and I think we probably have one more meeting to wrap it up. But I just wanted to report that from our point of view, when the 10-mile bridge railing comes back to you, it will be with a recommendation of this committee that we approve that railing design.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Schallenberger. And on behalf of myself and the other commissioners, we want to give you a lifetime appointment to this committee. Because Commissioner Potter and I have been stuck on the hotel committee for many years, and we don't like it either. So you're stuck there with Mad River Bridge and all the other things coming up with your expertise.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add my thanks to Commissioner Schallenberger and Caldwell and all those of you who have worked on this issue tirelessly. I think what Caltrans has come up with is really creative, what the committee has come up with. It's amazing what you can do when given the incentive to be creative. And I think this is a real success story, and I'm delighted, and I understand Commissioner Neely met with Caltrans on the Mad River Bridge, and that we're going to be seeing these, I think, aesthetically really pleasing designs more often. So, but for the work of this commission, I don't think that would have happened. So thank you for your good work.
Thank you, Director Douglas. Any other commissioners under commissioner reports? None. Okay, no more commissioner reports. We don't have a conservancy report.
Is there a Santa Monica Mountains
Conservancy report?
Well, I did attend the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy meeting, but I have to admit that I didn't write down what we did. So I'll provide a written report. There were a couple of issues of that involved the coastal zone, but I promise to be better in the future.
Okay. Deputy Attorney General's report.
Yes.
Commissioners, I only have one item to report, and it's that Mr. Geffen has delivered the check for $225,000 to our office in payment of attorney's fees as part of the settlement that we entered into with him. So that is now resolved. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I have a few items to report. We're still trying to find a way to deal with the federal cut in funding for the Coastal Commission's non-point source pollution control program, as I reported to you last time. That is a substantial reduction to funding for the Commission's water quality control program that we've been working on with the regional and state board and EPA. We have not yet identified a way to fund those cuts, and we are bringing it to the attention of the legislative budget subcommittees that this is a major unexpected reduction in the Commission's budget as a result of federal program cuts. We are also working with the congressional delegation to restore those funds in the next year's budget, but it's the budget that we're now dealing with in current year that we have greatest worries about. And I just want to mention to you that this commission has had a 25-year relationship with the Environmental Careers Organization, which is a national nonprofit that has helped the commission in terms of bringing fellows or fellowships and internships to help us carry out the mission of the commission. That organization is apparently no longer going to be functioning. They are planning to close their doors. So we're working with another foundation, nonprofit, to transfer the responsibilities and the services that had been provided by ECO to the commission to this other organization. It's an organization working out of UC Santa Cruz and relative to the Monterey Sanctuary. It's a foundation there that has agreed to take on these responsibilities, and I'll have more to report on that next time because we're just doing that now, and Susan Hanch is working to make that happen. I mentioned the requests that we're making to the legislative budget committees on funding for the commission and the commission's needs. As Commissioner Hueso pointed out, the grants for local governments to update their LCPs, the enforcement staff, energy, and water quality and the climate change issue that the commission has been wrestling with and that we're going to be spending a lot more time on in the future, we really feel that it's appropriate to ask for a position to help us prepare the work that's necessary to address the climate change issues. I was also asked on short notice to go to Mexico last week, which I did, and I was down there on a 24-hour turnaround at the request of the Goldman Institute at UC Berkeley and the Calderon administration to provide some advice and some recommendations relative to a coastal protection program for Mexico. This is at the national level, and those of you who've been to Mexico know that they need a program. The biggest issue is lack of enforcement. And I thought it was a very productive session. We had a good discussion on what really I think needs to be done, and offered the experience of this commission and California as a good model and example of what can be done to effectively protect their coastal resources. And it was an opportunity I felt I could not pass up. And while I was down there, I did talk to the Assistant Undersecretary of Cal EPA, Dan Skopek, about helping us with the climate change position that we're asking for, since Cal EPA and the Air Board are taking the lead in terms of implementing AB 32, the Climate Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act. So I thought that was very productive, and that is all I have to report on those items. And then I do have a legislative report. The legislative report lists the bills that we've been following. There are three bills that we've highlighted, and only one that we're recommending a position on at this point, and that's the Krikorian bill, AB 258, relative to plastics in the ocean, the reduction of the introduction of plastics into the ocean. The commission has a history of being involved in marine debris issues. You actually co-sponsored and organized the first Plastics in the Ocean conference in the country in Redondo Beach several years ago, and it was highly successful. The commission has been working on this issue, and the bill that that Assemblymember Krikorian has to reduce the introduction of plastics into the ocean, we think is very consistent with what the commission has been trying to do and has been supportive of in the past. And that's why we're recommending you support that that bill. If you have any questions on it.
Well, just one question, Mr. Douglas, I was going to ask you this morning. I was got sidetracked on the legislative. On the question of, it's already happened last month, AB 1459, I ran into a couple of legislators this last week or something, and they had a question of, I know we sent a letter to them that we oppose it, but we gave no reason, et cetera. And I just wonder, as one person, I think maybe it'd be helpful, according to legislators, that when we oppose something, we give a reason why the commission or support, why either we either support legislation or we oppose it. But I was under the impression we were writing a letter and we were opposing it, but with reasons why we opposed it. And I got a suggestion by one of the legislators that was there at the hearing that it'd be very helpful. Well, or they asked why we didn't, one, we didn't show up, and I understand why, because of the circumstances with Sarah Christie and her mother, et cetera, couldn't be there. But I do think, and I'm just asking you, I think when we oppose or support something, I was caught by surprise by this, that we should give the reasons why we oppose something or why we support it. It was just a couple. I guess we just sent a letter. It just said we oppose.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're right. And we did explain to the author why the commission opposed the bill, and we wanted to get a letter on file. So that was sent out while we were still in session here, just to get as quickly as possible the commission's position. And as you know from the report, the bill was defeated in committee.
Right.
So it's, but you're right.
But if it's still alive, and if it's still alive or something, I for one, I think we should get a letter ready and prepared if this is going to go on and why we opposed it. And
the bill is dead as far as I understand.
Okay. Well.
Is it a two-year bill?
You know, I don't know the answer to
you
that.
You asked me, there's something. That was one of the questions I asked you this morning. You know, that was it.
If you had, I'd have an answer for you.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
But I don't.
But that, I think we should do that.
It's not a two-year bill. It was on a one-year bill deadline.
Okay. Is there any other questions on legislation?
Down here. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, Commissioner Berg.
Oh,
Commissioner
Crane before me.
Okay.
Oh, I was just going to say if we could ascertain that bill is dead, and in the event that it has any life to it, I would like to request that a letter be sent that more fully explains our rationale. I think it's important that they understand it.
I don't have any qualms with that. The circumstances were such that the letter was just sent giving the position, but normally we do provide the reasons for it, and certainly we did provide that to the author and some other people who asked us about it,
right.
But it should have been in the letter. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay.
And so I yes. have asked you for just a vote on that bill.
To my recollection, help me out here. About 4.5 years ago, there was a replacement of pilings in a docks in Long Beach Harbor, and they wanted to use wooden pilings, and we required them to use a polymer-based piling so the wooden deteriorate. So how does that affect our opposition to plastic in the water?
No, the boy, trying to recall what the commission has historically done with respect to pilings is working with the Department of Fish and Game and EPA and others who are concerned about the leaching of toxins into the marine environment to turn to a type of piling that doesn't present that kind of hazard, whether it's wrapping the timbers in a particular material that doesn't raise the issue of toxins in the marine environment, or using a material in the first place that isn't going to leach. What this bill is talking about is a reduction of what you call nurdles. These are the little plastic particles that are used in the production of...
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, no, also the... nurdles are how plastic is transported to then be converted into a product. And in the course of transportation, loading, offloading, and actual use of that material, some of it does get out in the environment and it gets washed into the storm drains and it ends up going out in the ocean. And this is an attempt to reduce the introduction of those small nurdles into the marine environment. We think it's a good step, and it's consistent with what the commission has tried to do in the past and would like to see happen in the future, protect the marine environment. So we ask your support of that bill.
Commissioner Schellenberger and then Commissioner Wasel. We're ready anytime you are.
I move the commission take a position to support AB 258.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Schellenberger, seconded by Commissioner Wasel. Is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this? That's right. It's unanimously approved.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman, and the other two bills that we've highlighted here, the Laird bill, AB 1066, that would deal with local governments or the state providing assistance to local governments to incorporate climate change considerations into their local coastal program and into their general plan. Our position is that you know, we would we would ask at some point in the future for the commission to support the bill if it's amended, because it didn't include the Coastal Commission as one of the entities that needs to work with local government, as we are now already in instances of amendments to LCPs on this process. And we're working with the author to seek amendments to appropriately incorporate the commission's responsibility. I'm not going to recommend support if amended at this point. I just want to give you a heads up that the bill did come out of committee, I believe, maybe yesterday. In any event, it's been amended in a way that still creates problems for us. I haven't seen the amended language, and I would bring it back at the next month with a better understanding of what the author is really going to do relative to making sure that there's coordination and integration between general plan amendments and local coastal program amendments, and what the role of the commission and the resources agency is going to be. So that's just an informational item, and I would not recommend any position on that. The same with the Sumitian bill, SB 412. We've explained that, I mean, that bill is going through a number of changes as well. It's a question of how, if in fact it were to provide the kind of concerns that Commissioner Blank and other commissioners raised last time, how can the commission deal with the question of the relative merits and demerits of these various LNG terminal proposals? That would be fine if it were further up in the beginning of the process. Unfortunately, we're already so far down the road here in terms of LNG proposals being proposed and in some stage of the applicant or permitting process. Even the one in Long Beach, which has not gone away totally, it's still there, and I understand that there's some litigation on it, or it may come back in some other manifestation, but it's not gone as such. And as you know, the situation relative to BHP Billiton that you just acted on at the last meeting, we don't know what's going to happen to that. The governor still has a few days to decide on whether or not he's going to approve or deny that particular matter, and we don't know yet whether or not BHP is going to appeal the commission's decision on it, and what they're going to do with respect to the State Lands Commission. The intent of the bill is good, but the question is it going to make any difference in terms of the timing of these various LNG facilities? And we have some questions about the relative roles of the Energy Commission under this bill, the Commission's role, but we're not recommending any position at this point. We're going to continue to see what they're going to, how they're going to amend it, and how that affects the Commission's jurisdiction. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, because Commissioner Blank did ask last time if we could look at the question of potential legislation, and this came along in between. We didn't have anything to do with it, but it is out there to try to address the very concern that you had as you expressed your frustration with the whole process. That's a long way of saying we're not recommending a position on the bill at this point.
Thank you. Thank you.
Commissioner
Blank?
Director Douglas, will there be a time that you might recommend supporting this bill, or is it just in general? Is it because the language isn't gelled yet, or just because of your previous comments in the beginning of the discussion?
It's both, because the language is in flux, and I understand that there are amendments being worked on to the bill, and I'd rather come back to you when I see what those amendments are to make sure our concerns would be addressed relative to your jurisdiction and responsibility under the Coastal Act. And the other is, I think, the more fundamental question of what difference is it going to make at this point, given where the current proposals for LNG terminals are in the process.
Okay. So I just would like to comment on that and go on the record to say I would request you to bring it back up when the language does change. I personally am very interested in supporting a bill like this and would like to have further discussion, but I will defer to your judgment about its current state. Is that okay?
Okay, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Commissioner Riley?
Well, I just also comment that given the speed of our process at times, that a legislation may or may not end up being timely on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. That's good. Is that it, Director Douglas? Because we have some public comment.
Yes, that's
six
that
or
completes
so on.
My
we still
report.
Have a closed session, and
thank
I'm trying
you.
To. Okay. With that, we'll go to public comment. First, Mark Massara, and then Marsha Hanscom. And then Steve Kaufman. How much time are you requesting, sir?
4 minutes. I shouldn't need it.
How about 3 minutes?
Okay, I'll try to do it. Thank you. Honorable Chair, Commissioners, I'm Mark Massara, and I represent Sierra Club's Coastal Programs. As the attorney representing Sierra Club in your discussions regarding the lures matter, I can't help but disagree with the characterization that you lost that case because of some fault of your staff. You lost that case because you explicitly violated the clear language of the local coastal plan that governed review over that particular project. And no amount of post hoc rationalizing would have covered up that fact. Second, much of your concerns here regarding this indemnification provision appear to me to be somewhat of a red herring, because when you get sued by a developer, they will, in virtually every case, agree to forego attorney's fees if you'll just do what they say, do what they want. The cases where you lose involving a public interest organization are in those vast majority of cases involving situations where you have sided with developers over the sound advice of your staff and the public. That said, the real heart of this discussion, it appears to us, would be that how can you resist the efforts of developers and lobbyists and not how you can manipulate your staff to try to justify these decisions. More importantly, and the real reason I'm up here, is that on behalf of the California Coastkeeper Alliance, the Coastal Protection Network, the League for Coastal Protection, Sierra Club's Coastal Protection Programs, and Surfrider Foundation, it is our pleasure to provide you with copies of the California Coastal Commission Conservation Voting Chart for 2006. As we have now done for over 20 years, we have attempted here to synthesize and analyze what we believe were some of the highlights associated with your work in 2006. And while the conservation results for 2006 are noticeably down from 2005, we hope that as we all take the time to revisit these projects and votes, that we can use them to improve analysis and coastal protection in the future so that scores in 2007 and beyond will increase dramatically. As always, we welcome your comments and insight regarding how we compiled this important chart, and any comments that you might have will be especially relevant in the next few weeks as we publish the chart on the web and provide copies to appointing authorities and members of the state legislature. Thank you.
Commission Chair Crewer, I'd like to go after Diana Spielberger and Yolanda Gonzalez, please.
That's fine.
That's all right.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Diana Spielberger. I'm here on behalf of Marina Peninsula Neighborhood Association. And I'm here to alert you to our formal request for revocation of the coastal development permit given to Pacific Jewish Center. The CDP allows a 200-pound test fishing line. You can see this here probably when it glints. To be strung between city light poles down Oceanfront Walk in Venice and between pole extenders that are going to be 20 feet high strapped to county signs all the way down the beach in front of homes. And attached to our submission are a number of photographs that I will direct your attention to. But in any event, this is a request that you set a hearing on for a revocation request. Pursuant to Section 13105, Subsection A, grounds for revocation of a permit are intentional inclusion of inaccurate, erroneous, or incomplete information in connection with a coastal development permit application where the Commission finds that accurate and complete information would have caused the Commission to require additional or different conditions on a permit or to deny an application. There are a number of situations where the project description includes incomplete and erroneous. For example, the location of the county signs. The applicant claims there are 19 county signs on the sand in front of the homes on the stretch of the Marina Peninsula. And in fact, there are only 10. There aren't 19. There's no way that they can stretch this. It says there's 19. Okay, now, and one of their selling points was we're not going to put any additional poles or posts in the sand. So that's just inaccurate. It's erroneous. It's untrue. Then the applicant states that they're going to stretch this wire between light poles all the way from Santa Monica down Oceanfront Walk to Catamaran Street. That's the project description. But at Washington is the last light pole. There are no existing light poles at all from Washington all the way to Catamaran. And there's no county sign at Catamaran to strap an existing, to strap one of these pole extenders to anyway. So there's further a problem that these pole extenders were not really discussed in terms of their weight. In fact, one of the papers that I saw indicated that the...
Ma'am, your time's up.
Oh, how much did I have?
3 minutes.
Oh. All right. May I just say...
No, Mr. Chairman.
A couple more words, because I didn't know. I'm sorry. No. But I would really appreciate your attention to those photographs at the back of the submission where the applicant claimed that monofilament line is being used at Mother's Beach. And you can see there the pole extenders, that they're 20 feet high, and they're all tipping over because the foundations for the poles don't support.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Gonzalez. Thank you. Commissioner Burke.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to congratulate Mrs. Spielberger on the work she's done on this. Because this is a project which I honestly believe that I was misled on. And I don't know what the appropriate procedural manner would be to reevaluate this if it's even possible. But if it is possible, I think that in light of all the information provided for us in her document, much of which... And I've been watching this as it's been going along because it's not far from my house. It's something that the commission just did not, I feel, get the appropriate information on. And we need to reconsider this.
Okay.
If I could ask Director Douglas if there is a procedure for this.
Well, it's my understanding that the party who just spoke to the commission made that a request for revocation. There is a procedure for revocation requests, and I don't know whether she's filled out or filed a formal request with our office. We will need that in writing, and then my understanding is we would then look at the request and the information and schedule it for... Commission consideration. I don't know if there's a... The timing on that would be, but that's the process. As you know, the standard in the Coastal Act is very high relative to the findings that have to be made to revoke a permit that's been previously approved by the commission. But that's the process that would be available.
In all the time I've been here, I've never agreed with any revocation because the standard is so high. But if I've ever seen one that comes close enough to meeting it, this is the case.
Commissioner Burke?
Yes.
I think we're going a little too far here because we're not having a hearing on revocation.
They have to fill it out. Has to go in. They have to bring it back.
I agree. I understand what you want. And does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah. Yolanda González?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah, Ms. Gonzalez, how much time do you want?
3 minutes.
3 minutes?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm Yolanda Gonzalez, and I'm the vice president for the Venice Neighborhood Council. And this was assigned to my committee, neighborhood committee, and I'd like to support Diana Spielberg on her information because, A, first of all, the neighborhood council was never informed about this issue, and you know that our land use planning committee is doing an excellent job in Venice as it is reporting back to you on our projects in Venice. Second and foremost, I think Bill Rosendahl was misinformed on this issue, and I myself have gone down to review this information, and what is here is accurate. And as a matter of fact, I was down there on Thursday. As a matter of fact, I even caught bronchial pneumonia after it because we had some very, very high winds down there. And I've been after Harbors and Beaches to clean up their mess on Washington and all along because we have a mess down there with the amount of tourists that are coming down and see this mess with lines. And they're even making the restaurants take down their lines and to put them underground because of the high wind factor that we have this year in at the beach. I have invited the Jewish Pacific Center to come, and they did come to one of our executive meetings, and I have called them. We even made a recommendation if they'd like to take it through mediation, through the Human Relations Department. We did talk to Rabbi Freeling, and we are in the position to even have a forum on this. But based on this information, and they did not give us facts, nor do they want to come and have an open meeting on this. By Jewish law, they're supposed to, believe it or not. I have to take back this information, but I personally would go back to my neighborhood council and tell them that we need to more information and support. And another thing that I'd like to say, too, is that at our board meeting last month, we had an incident where there also there's a one gentleman who's trying to also claim his religious rights of Muslim religion, Shea Butter, because we're having problems. As a matter of fact, Linda Lux, who is our commissioner and president, who heads our Oceanfront Walk committee, this should have gone to her first and then gone on to land use and then back to our committee, to our executive committee. And so we've been misinformed ourselves, and I'm going to make sure that Bill Rosendahl finds out about this. And But we need more information. This is a very serious thing. And I had the galls, as a matter of fact, to file a police report against this guy who came in and disrupted our meeting. And I'm going to follow up. Bill, Officer SLO, Robin Richards has the information. If you're more than welcome to get that information from him, okay?
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
And on this issue, if a supervisor from Los Angeles County calls the office, I think it should be an ex parte. Because, that's not right.
Honorable Commissioners, Marcia Hanscom with the Coastal Law Enforcement Action Network, and I'm also vice chair of the Conservation Committee for the Sierra Club Angeles chapter.
3 minutes.
Three minutes. Clean has joined with the Marina Peninsula Neighborhood Association and submitted a revocation request today. This letter is a revocation request in compliance with the regulations, and we
would ask that these wires that are in the midst of environmentally sensitive habitat areas and immediately adjacent to an endangered least term preserve, by the way, this shorebird travels all the way from Guatemala and southern Mexico every year to our beach in Los Angeles. It's one of the most successful least tern nesting sites for a bird that is on the brink of extinction. And it's here right now if you want to come see it. I'd be happy to show it to you. They're gorgeous birds, and watching them feed in these lagoons is just an incredible sight. But our legal grounds, which we believe are quite solid for the scheduling of this revocation hearing, are outlined in the letter we've submitted to you. I'd like to refer you to these attachments. The project description, as Ms. Spielberger said, it was inaccurate. The applicant states that permits were received by the city and county. They were not. The applicant also did not use the established procedures for legal notice. They were not followed, and there are no addresses in the file. It's very clear that they did not do the proper legal notification of people within 100 feet as required by the law. And I would also say that there is a possible other revocation ground based on the fact that in Exhibit 7 of tomorrow's findings, which you'll see, there's an attachment to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service letter that's not in the commission file that says that these, I'll read to you exactly what it says here. It says that, this is from the Fish and Wildlife Service, it says that they do not anticipate any take in the form of harm or harassment to occur to the California least tern from the coastal area based on the minimization measures proposed below in the attachment. Those minimization measures were not put forward by the applicant, and we don't even know what they are. So that may be one other ground for revocation, but we found so many inconsistencies, errors, and incomplete information that we believe this is grounds for at least a revocation hearing. And the law says that at the next regularly scheduled meeting and after notice to the permittee and any permit persons, the executive director has reason to know, would be interested, the executive director shall report the request for revocation to the commission with a preliminary recommendation on the merits of the request. So we believe this needs to be scheduled for next month's meeting based on Section 13108 of the California Code of Regulations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanscom. No, ma'am, we can't do that.
I have another one in there.
No, you don't get two. Thank you.
On another issue?
No. You only have 3 minutes. Thank you very much for coming, though. Thank you. It's the last public comment speaker slip. And so with that, we'll close for the day, and we'll go into... Mr. Kaufman, I'm sorry. He wanted to... We rotated people around there, and I'm sorry,
okay,
before we...
No. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to take...
3 minutes.
1 minute.
Thank you.
Hopefully less. You know, at the time I filled out the speaker slip, I had a burning desire to talk to you about this indemnity condition, and then your discussion followed, and it really fully aired the issues and questions on all sides, and I compliment you on that. What I'm hopeful is, at this point, that staff will put this condition on ice until you have a chance to fully look at the legal issues and the policy implications, so we don't have to deal with this on a case-by-case basis. Out of the 37, 38 applications and amendments you have on this agenda, you have one more on Friday that raises this condition. And we think that it would be helpful to be able to address this all at one time rather than piecemeal. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaufman. Okay, with that, we'll...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do have a closed session. Unless there are more public speakers... No more. Is there anyone else here who wants to make a public comment, submitted a speaker slip? Okay, if not, we could ask the room to please clear, and we can have a closed session. Then we'll have to come back in and report on the outcome of the closed session. And it's going to be relatively short. And then we'll adjourn and see you again tomorrow morning.
received information concerning the litigation and took no action. And then finally, the commission discussed Coastal Commission versus Michael Allen, and the commission agreed to extend the assignment agreement concerning the judgment lien. And that concludes my report regarding closed session.
Well, thank you. Thank
we'll
you very much.
We'll see you at 9 tomorrow morning.
See you at 9.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you.